The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA is the important part that obviously stands for question and answers. We like to make this a bit more of an interactive conversation. I'm already seeing some amazing names in the live chat, in the stream already. TK Bay. Everybody say good morning to TK, but we've got Dustadori, Simon Says Hypno, Dave Burns, Aditya Anil, Farhan, Otaku, missing people, Mamikan, Gormlord, who else was in here? McCorkerin! Yes, we've got a full complement of big old geeks. I don't know, I mean, I'm quantifying the amount of their geekness, not their actual physical stature. everybody for tuning in. I'm kind of rushing and a bit anxious. Last week was a pajama podcast where we tried to do something even a little more different for this channel. I've been absolutely adoring my time with the Steam Deck. It's radically changed my PC gaming habits and behavior just in the couple weeks that I've had it. So last week's pajama podcast was just basically regular Twitch-style game streaming. Apologies to folks. I got a couple angry messages from people like, hey, where's the audio version of the podcast this week? I know it's a pajama podcast, but you still put those out. Well, a game stream doesn't translate into an actual audio show. Like, no one, you're not going to want to listen to me play Vampire Survivors for 2 hours. So I do apologize. I really probably should have tried to handle that a little bit better, but it was absolutely the kind of relaxed stream that I needed, and I think it's probably incumbent on me to look at a few more of those opportunities where maybe we just do some more legit game streaming, but we don't use that as podcast filler, because they don't really translate. You know, you go to a podcast, you're expecting some kind of show or commentary or conversation, and then some guy's like, but do you think I should do an all-garlic build? Clack, 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 clack. Oh no, the bad guys are killing me. Click, click, clack, click, clack. It's not really a podcast. So, DJ is saying, yeah, just for poops and giggles, you should have made an audio version of last week's show. I Yeah, I really did kind of drop the ball on that. Maybe for fun, or maybe I'll put it on the Patreon. If you need the sound of someone like playing some couch co-op video gaming with you, here's 2 hours of me streaming from my Steam Deck. We have so much news to cover. So welcome back, everybody. This is a properly formatted show, and I don't want to sacrifice for the last couple weeks. It's been working really well. Get through the news block, do a briefer subreddit plug, talk about some of the gadget news, and then field more Q&A at the end of each show, especially for the absolutely insane number of gadgets on my desk right now. The podcast has to be a better place to chat about some of this stuff. I've been living the stylus life crazy. Like, I'm gonna hold up my Stylo 6 here. No, here's the TCL Stylus 5G, and at the same time, we finally got the Motorola Folio case, which also comes with the little stylus pen in here too. I mean, productivity devices. I got a new display from YouPerfect, which is just rocking my socks right now. There's so much going on. We're gonna try and stick to that schedule. The trickiest part of sticking to that schedule is gonna be housekeeping, and like I didn't do any housekeeping last week, there was a lot that went out this last week. Oh, Farhan, absolutely, the Folio case is gonna be worth a video. So here's what I'm gonna be doing. I'm gonna be doing a wrap-up video on the Motorola because I have a buddy that I want to send this to because I think he's also gonna really enjoy it too. So I'm trying to sort of scramble through my final coverage on the Moto Edge Plus 2022. Spoiler, it's getting exceedingly glowing responses from me for exactly what this phone is trying to accomplish. But part of that was also getting this new YouPerfect display to talk about the desktop mode. So I kind of want to do a final wrap-up on Ready 4 productivity features and the Folio case, kind of as the we can complete the review that we couldn't finish when the Edge Plus launched. Now we can finish that conversation. So it's all going to be kind of jumbled up together into one because I really don't have the bandwidth to turn that into three separate videos. So let's finish this out. Dave Burns, do you get to keep the Moto? I don't know. My relationship with Qualcomm. So this was sent to me through Qualcomm to talk about 8 Gen 1 performance, and we're going to be talking about 8 plus Gen 1 performance in this video, where some of those conversations are a little sensitive, I'm sure, from Qualcomm's perspective. I know TK had to send his back at some point. They haven't asked for it back yet, so I'm going to kind of try and rock it for as long as I can until they say, like, oh, hey, yeah, glad you really enjoyed your time with the phone. Maybe you should send it back. Or if they give me the official, like, yeah, you can run with it. Because what I'd also like to do is sort of spread the wealth. There are a couple other YouTube channels where a Motorola might not have been on their radar, and I think they would also really dig what this phone is doing, especially those folks that used to really enjoy the more Android stock flavor of OnePlus. If you're into the Sony aesthetic, where it's very, very minimal in terms of UI changes, this is mostly material design and Moto gestures. Like, again, there are some very distinct pros and cons happening. I've even shot a video, I don't know when it'll go live, but I've even shot sort of a longer term look at the phone for reviews.org. It's just such a unique premium tier phone. When we're all talking about a lack of competition, and here's a Moto that's actually kind of crushing it right now. So, let's get this out of the way here. Barry Johnson says, "Hello, Juan and fellow chatters." Oh man, we gotta get in. We gotta get in. I'm gonna get all distracted here. All right, for housekeeping, we're gonna fly. I've done so much. So here's the rundown. I finally finished this video on the Odyssey Euclid $1,300 planar magnetic earbuds, and these are going to be the tough ones. Like, I'm going to be real sad to send these back. I don't know that I've personally listened to any earbuds that are as close to perfect as these babies have been.
I am very, very pleased with the performance on the Odyssey Euclid. I'm joining a conversation that's pretty well fleshed out at this point, but they rocked my socks. Did you get to keep the Odyssey? No, I don't believe I get to keep the Odyssey. The major video last week, Vivo X80 Pro camera upgrades and improvements, part two of our series with Vivo, checking out the X80 Pro, one of the monster camera performers of the year. I've got one other video that we're going to be putting out this week, part three, where we're going to compare the X80 Pro against my mirrorless cameras. And then I also have a video shot I need to start editing, Vivo X80 Pro versus Xperia 1 Mark IV. If you're looking at the bleeding edge of smartphone camera tech, the X80 Pro is impressing in some very, very significant ways. At the same time, the folks at Vivo on the iQOO label sent me over, I mean, this is something we can also talk about a little bit more in the gadget block, the iQOO Neo 6. This is a $450 phone, 120Hz refresh rate OLED, Snapdragon 870, for the equivalent of $450, and that's for the 12 gigabytes of RAM, 256 gigs of storage model. So the higher tier version of this is kind of smack dab in the range of like a Pixel 5a. I mean, we're going to be getting ready for Pixel 6a. It's incredible how long lived the Snapdragon 870 has been. And this is just a monster performing phone for what's kind of the middle mid-range price tier. And then I also got to wrap up housekeeping with with a pair of editorials. I revisited the OnePlus 10 Pro. Now, this isn't like a, you know, after 2 months, review something. This is more just sort of a response that I've been feeling to a number of articles or reviews that I've seen on the OnePlus 10 Pro. And, you know, just that the OnePlus 10 Pro, I mean, it's good, but is that enough? It needs to be special, you know? Or there's some kind of ho-hum in the flavor of that commentary. And we don't see that kind of flavor of shrug and a sigh when folks are talking about Galaxy S22s. I think the Galaxy S22s are demonstrably poorer options than a OnePlus 10 Pro. If you can't step up to a Note 22, you should avoid the S22 and S22 Plus. They are corner-cutting examples of Samsung trying to save cash. They aren't good phones at that price. Like, they're the perfect advertisements for why you should just go buy an iPhone, unless you're looking at some devices like a OnePlus 10 Pro or a Moto Edge that deliver something unique at that sub $1,000 price tier. So I put out an editorial video, just what does it take? What does it take to make something feel more specialer? And what changes that narrative? Because I'm really tired of this, like, lazy surface level techie enthusiast whinging about, oh, OnePlus used to be a flagship killer, now they're just a flagship. Yeah. Just a flagship. They're making some of the best phones the company has ever made. And they're good phones. So what are we complaining about? I really don't get it. And it really boils down to, there's like a tier of tech enthusiast that's basically just a fancy purse shopper. I don't want to yuck anyone's yum. If all you care about is flashing the right label on your purse, go enjoy spending more money on that purse. I can't make videos for that. That's not who I like to talk to in the world of tech. If you're telling me it doesn't matter how good a OnePlus can be, the OnePlus label never deserves to be more expensive because it used to be a flagship killer label, all you're telling me is, I only care about the label. I only want to show off that the label on my phone was less expensive than the label on your phone. And that's it. That's all you have to offer this conversation, and you'll be much happier watching someone else's videos. You don't have to lurk in the comments on my YouTube channel. So, the other editorial, you know how I kind of got a little, like, snarly in that last little section talking about the OnePlus 10 Pro? I'm trying to do a better job of recognizing when I'm going from snarky fun to just kind of actually mean. And so I did cancel a video. I was writing and scripting a video for the X80 Pro, and in much the same way, complaining about this, like, it's not on a Samsung, it's not on an iPhone, so instead of appreciating progress on another phone, we're going to complain and be concerned that maybe that feature's too good. You know, I don't get that kind of night mode performance on my Galaxy, and I don't get that kind of night mode performance on an iPhone. So maybe the low light camera tech on the X80 Pro is too bright. I mean, it's a night photo, right? It should be dark. High five. I've got terrible hot takes on technology. So I wrote out this script kind of picking apart why I feel like that's such a tragic, like it's so smugly, confidently ignorant. I don't really know how to talk to that person. I can't be an educational resource for someone who chooses, who goes out of their way to choose to be terrible at technology and photography. Like, you have to be really bad at tech to look at an improvement to a feature and then say, but I don't want it to get better. It needs to be harder to use and have poorer output. Like, you're dumb. Like, you're just proper dumb at that point. So I shared the script on the Patreon. It's called Canceled Video, Vivo X80 Pro, But What If the Night Mode Is Too Good? It starts out kind of on brand for me. It's snarky and it's funny. By the end of it, when I'm reading it in my voice, by the end of it, I can't see the smile anymore. Like, I'm showing teeth, but it's not smile teeth. It's like snarl teeth. And so people have said, you know, like if you rewrite it, or, you know, this could still be for a fun video. I'm not in the right headspace to share this video. It would just be me like ranting, like actually angry at people who are making this conversation about progress more difficult. So, Barry Johnson. Hold on, I've got to find. I just saw it on the Twitch. That script should be under glass, and we should review it at least once a year. kind of as an example of how to really share your feelings, but not how to make a good video. So I canceled that one. Oh, Farhan, thank you so much. I saw your X80 Pro photos from your Facebook page, and it's seriously amazing. The night mode shots are like voodoo. Because it's not just, can it make a bright video? What I've been very impressed with is how correct it is in choosing colors based on extremely bad lighting. And that, to me, is one of the critical advantages that we've seen, even from the X70 Pro Plus. The X80 Pro is doing stuff that is absolutely remarkable for computational photography. Dave Burns, it's Juan's therapy time in script form. Oh, and Dustadori with a highlighted message. I choose to be bad at tech. There's a little bit of that going on. For me, it's some of the absolute most obvious commentary is now getting rolled up into people just trying to put out these like jokey poop talking hot takes, and you're like, it's not even funny. You're just really bad at this. And we have a Patreon question that I'm gonna talk about at the end of this. At the end of this podcast, too. Something that I want to make a more regular segment. Someone delivered just a great, like, it's a great question on smartphone photography. You know, it's one that I wanted to spend a little time answering. And again, if folks want to sort of contribute and participate, you know, the Patreon is increasingly becoming one of the better places for me to just hang out and answer questions and really get deep into the weeds. Like, I know the commenting system on Patreon kind of sucks, but there's so much less noise on Patreon that I can kind of find these really good questions easier, and we can get into some more in-depth conversations. Oh, Farhan, yeah, and Gabaletta. Just talking about, so, I mean, like, Farhan's comment here, replying to Gabaletta, preach, it's about time people get wise and learn not to fully trust popular sponsored techies. It's more, like, I mean, I'm working on a Vivo sponsorship. I need to be upfront about that. I am collaborating with them. There is a monetary exchange in time and effort for energy and video production. And I feel like with the appropriate disclosures on, this is how income is generated on YouTube videos, I feel like that's fine. It's more kind of untangling. There's a tone or a character to a tech review where even if it's not a sponsored video from a company like Samsung or Apple, if it's a Western reviewer, we can be somewhat confident that a chunk of their coverage leans into a certain audience on YouTube because that's how they'll generate larger audience retention numbers. And when those audience scores are doing very well, they will make more money from sponsorships. So if you just go out onto YouTube and tell Apple and Samsung owners that they're correct for owning Apple and Samsung, well, that's 80% of the United States smartphone market. So those are pretty easy metrics to hit, you know, just confirming the bias of that audience. That to me is the more insidious part. I feel like you're probably safer these days if someone's just upfront like, hey, we're going to check out some cool things you can do on live streaming. And this was brought to you by the Stream Deck from Elgato. You're like, okay, I know what I'm in for. And I know what this video is going to be about. And I know, you know, sort of what the tone and character is, but if it's sort of like, well, I'm an unbiased, objective reviewer, but here's why you should never buy anything but a Samsung, that can't be true. Because as we've already talked about, the Galaxy S22s are hot garbage this year. Do not buy them. Unless you can get them, like, for free, and you're okay with a horrifically compromised premium tier flagship phone experience, great. I guess that's fine. But even for free, I would be much happier using any other premium tier phone this year than an S22. So again, I find that color of the commentary to be the most suspect. Oh, Aditya, that is very kind and very generous of you kind of shouting out the Patreon like that and highlighting the message. That's very cool. So, excuse me. I'm going to be muting my mic a bit more. I've got like a little tickle in the back of my throat. We have a ton of news. Housekeeping took just a bit longer than I thought, so I'm going to fly. This is stuff that is just ongoing. We need to keep an eye on it. And I want to save most of the news block to talk about a major success for some of the political process that we've been talking about in the world of technology. Dave Burns, and it's easier to harass Juan on the Patreon, too. Simon says Hypno. Okay. I very much appreciate you saying that. He says, I actually really like the angry Juan writings. Good text should evoke real emotions. I definitely wear my heart on my sleeve. I've lived my life out of mobility and gadgets. From my first Texas Instruments pocket organizer, through my graphing calculator fixations, all the way to today where I'm trying to replace laptops and consoles with phones. This is obviously something I get very passionate about. For me, it's finding the mental health balance where something can be cathartic, and releasing a video like that night mode video wouldn't have been cathartic. It would have just made me angrier. Otaku, shaking my head. Juan is politicking again. Don't you know that politicians don't affect you if you ignore it? Yeah, this is a victory. I'm gonna be happy to share this victory. But first, let's cover a trio of ongoing stories that we should just keep your eyes on. I don't like it when a singular figurehead can have this much influence over markets, over industries, and over news cycles. And so whatever your feelings are on Elon Musk, I think we could say he's having kind of a roller coaster rocky ride over this last week. So first of all, from an AP press release, but I caught it on just the Microsoft news feed, Elon Musk is threatening to end his $44 billion agreement to buy Twitter, accusing company of refusing to give him information about its spam bot accounts. Lawyers for the Tesla and SpaceX CEO made the threat in a letter to Twitter dated Monday that the social platform included in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The letter says Musk has repeatedly asked for the information since May 9th, about a month after his offer to buy the company, so he could evaluate how many of the company's 229 million accounts are fake. So this is the actual quote I wanted to get to. This is a clear material breach of Twitter's obligations under the merger agreement, and Mr. Musk reserves all rights resulting therefrom, including his right not to consummate the transaction and his right to terminate the merger agreement. I'm fine with this. I get it. I mean, if this calls more light onto Twitter bots and we can get better tools for sort of eliminating fake accounts, sure. I just think it's so funny for... How do I want to phrase this? I think it's so funny because Musk is such a champion of free speech, right? He's like made it so clear that as soon as he gets Twitter, he's going to look at bringing back all of the voices that have been silenced by the woke. You know, I can't speak for anyone else in this audience, but my quality of life improved tremendously when figureheads like President Trump were just removed from the platform. At some point, the terms of service of Twitter need to be enforced for people in higher levels of power. And if all you're going to do is lie and spread misinformation and weaponize disinformation, then you don't have any place on a private company's platform if that's against their terms of service. That's the gig. There is no First Amendment issue there. The government cannot force you to publish speech you don't like. At the same time, bots are also a form of free speech in the most hideous and horrendous way possible. If money is speech and someone with a lot of money can buy a lot of bots, then you're kind of running counter to your own claims about caring about free speech as defined by the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Do I wish we could change that? Heck yeah, I do. So all of Elon Musk's failing in this regard could stand to make Twitter a better platform with less free speech, if money is speech. And I don't know, he's taking a beating in the public court of opinion, and I'm kind of okay with that. I think Musk has been overdue a market correction on this cult of personality that he's built about him being this eccentric genius. The farther he strays into right-wing politics, the more he has to deal with the pressure of his own positions on that matter. And that's what free speech is. It doesn't mean I'm free to say what I want free of consequences. It means I'm free to say what I want and the government can't throw me in jail. That's it. You would think that someone who's really into that tough talk, free speech, all opinions matter kind of vibe wouldn't be so sensitive about like bots on the platform, because that's a component of social media paid speech at this point. Gavaletta. I don't think he ever believed they were real. Gabby writes, the fact that Elon Musk believed that all of those accounts are real should showcase he's the wrong person to own Twitter. I don't think he ever believed they were real. I think he's using this as a convenient excuse to try and back out after Tesla shares plummeted. The value of those shares reduced, the value of those shares dropped. So his ability to just throw money at buying Twitter, he has a lot less economic leverage than he used to when Tesla shares were higher. So that means he's going to have to borrow more money. If he borrows more money than he currently does, the interest on the money that he'll be borrowing will radically outpace the amount of revenue that Twitter can generate. That's the tricky spot that he's in. So I think he's just using this bot issue as his parachute. Twitter can't tell me that they don't have bots on their platform. anyone who's used Twitter knows that it's just full of bots. Same thing with Facebook. There are so many fake accounts. You don't go into buying Twitter, but I need to know exactly how many. I don't know, like half? Sure. You know, I have 3 accounts on Twitter. I'm a real person. I don't know that you should count me 3 times as a user on Twitter. Okay? That's just the reality of a social media platform today. So this isn't real. This is all just grandstanding and theater, because now he's going to be feeling a bit more of that economic hurt, and there's no way for him to turn Twitter into a profitable entity just by reducing staff. That was also going to be a part of the big plan. Like, we'll make more money if we can bring in the same revenue but pay fewer people. That's always a good plan. Do a barrel roll. Because that's also one of the issues facing Tesla. So this is a story coming by way of Reuters. Elon Musk backtracks on job cuts, says Tesla salaried staff to be fairly flat. So, this is an ongoing just will he or won't he, the eccentricities of Elon Musk getting in the way of a company trying to just do good business. I am a big fan of Tesla. I think they've got incredible engineers and brilliant people working for the company. I am increasingly less confident in Elon Musk's ability to be the figurehead of all of that work. So this is coming on the heels of Musk demanding that people come back to office. It's time to stop pretending you're working. All of this BS. I mean, just tragically bad look. These are the people that were keeping Tesla running during a global pandemic. Work from home, we've actually seen productivity increase. Companies were making more money during the pandemic, especially technology-based companies. And for Musk to act like, you freeloaders have had it too good during 2 years of a global pandemic is such a slap in the face to everybody who moved heaven and earth to keep these billion-dollar corporations functional. So he sort of sidetracked on that, but he did this big play. Well, if you don't think you can make back to the off 40 hours, you can pretend to go work for some other company. I'm Elon Musk in Texas. Lame. Super lame. So I feel like that was, again, I feel it was a kind of a transparent play at looking at how might you be able to get a few people to quit, right? If we can reduce staff in some ways, then there's a likelihood that we can have fewer layoffs, right? Because immediately after that, there was still an announcement of layoffs. Oh, yeah, we're still going to have to cut numbers at Tesla. And now it just seems like they're going to try and cut salaried numbers. Like, well, we're going to grow, but it's going to be more hourly positions, not salary positions. The salary positions should stay mostly flat. This is all hedging in very hedging language in very uncertain ways. And again, I was sitting at my computer when some of this news broke. I had like $1,000 in, you know, in disposable fun money. I was sitting there really thinking, like, I know nothing about stocks. Should I short Tesla? Because I missed shorting Netflix. And you're like, oh man, I really should have. I was so close to pulling the trigger on a stock trade that I was not qualified to make. But the guess would have paid out. Again, it would have been a pretty decent payday. I'm so sad. Because I don't want to pile on the bad news for Tesla. I still feel like they are one of the primary forces in encouraging people to reconsider the notion of the electric vehicle. I am always going to have a nerd soft spot in my heart for what Tesla has accomplished. But I think because of how uncertain and how unstable Musk can be as a figurehead, that when there's a little bit of blood in the water, we're going to see this piling on. So from a couple days ago, AP also reported United States has over 750 complaints of Tesla's braking for no reason. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration revealed the number in a detailed information request letter to Tesla that was posted Friday on the agency's website. The 14-page letter, dated May 4th, asks the automaker for all consumer and field reports it has received about false braking, as well as reports of crashes, injuries, deaths, and property damage claims. It also asks whether the company's full self-driving and automatic emergency braking systems were active at the time of any incident. So it seems to me like that's a pretty standard. There's an issue with the product. We've got to look at what the numbers actually represent. Can we get better data? And Tesla now needs to reply to the traffic agency, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. What is it? NHTSA? Is that what we call it? So just to kind of keep an eye on what's going on with Tesla, for something tells me like, that might even just be as simple as like a software patch. But a story like that gets amplified when there's already some ill will or some less favorable sentiment of Elon Musk. That, again, it's one of those things like when you've got a figurehead at your company who can kind of create that Jobs-like reality distortion field, the bad news sort of gets pushed aside. Well, don't worry, they're going to take care of it. They're going to update it. They're going to fix it. Everything's going to be great. But when the figurehead doesn't seem to display that confidence for consumers, then these types of stories get a little bit more critical examination or a little more critical attention. Yeah, Farhan is saying, braking for no reason, that sounds like an autopilot fail to me. There's probably just something in how the car is recognizing certain driving conditions that is causing an abundance of caution and a brake to be engaged. That doesn't sound to me like it would be too tragic of a system to fix, but we also need the data to see, has anyone really been hurt by this? Has there been any kind of issue or safety, or does it require a more drastic recall? You know, that's the kind of information and data that we need. And so that's what we're going to get from Tesla. I'm actually not too concerned about the cars themselves. I think when we saw the runaway throttle on Toyotas, it didn't instantly mean Toyotas were a no-buy, but linking of a series of negative emotions to Elon Musk. Elon Musk is the CEO of Tesla, and Teslas have some issues with braking. Man, that is a bad cocktail for Elon Musk to be sipping at right now. That's too much news all at once. From Twitter to Tesla to some of the issues with SpaceX to money and financials, less confidence in the stock market. That's not a good week. So I would say Elon Musk is not having a good week. moving on, in other EV news, Sony and Honda are going to be making a side venture. Excuse me. This was written up by Steve Dent over on Engadget. Sony and Honda recently announced plans to build EVs together. We covered that on the podcast, by the way. Honda focusing on the manufacturing, Sony creating the mobility service platform. Now it looks like the companies plan to make it a separate business. Quote, we shared the view that it is better to make the joint venture independent in the long run rather than putting it under Sony or Honda. I kind of like this idea. Just something a little fresh. Honda's core business doesn't need to be impacted. You know, there's no expectation that now suddenly, you know, every Honda needs to be this. Are you getting the Sony flavored Honda, or are you just getting the Honda? Like, there's something kind of cool about two major technology players, two Japanese companies kind of coming together and say, hey, we can work together on this. Let's really make it fresh. No expectations that it's going to be the Sony car, and people will all laugh about, oh, is it going to be the PlayStation car? Are you going to play your PlayStation in your PlayStation car? sorry, I don't know. I went all Daniel Tosh there. So none of that expectation. Make it something new, make it something fresh. I wonder if something like this is going to have a bigger impact on the EV market than rebranding an existing company. I didn't actually include the link in the show notes, but Buick, GM is now saying, we're going to take Buick and that's going to be our tip of the spear company. And that they're really going to focus on making Buick an independent EV manufacturer separate from the other GM brands. And I think that's really interesting. Like, can you change the perception of old man car Buick into something a bit more fresh, into something a bit more current, a bit more on the pulse? Can you get younger consumers interested in those cars? Or is that Buick badge, is that Buick label too ingrained in a certain idea of older consumers? So why I want us to kind of focus on the EV market. Sony and Honda don't want the baggage. They're going to go with a fresh brand new label. Buick has all the baggage, and GM is looking to see if they can create a new feel looking at that label. Two very different approaches to creating fresh new electric vehicles for this market right now. So amidst like the Chevy Bolt just got a bunch of price slashes. Like, I think now the starting price for a Chevy Bolt is like $5,000 cheaper than it used to be. The demand and the interest is in EVs is climbing. It's you know, higher than it was last year. Gas prices certainly contributing. We hit $6.40 at the gas station near our house. I am very seriously tooling around our neighborhood now on an electric scooter for when I used to just like, I'll just jump in the car and take a quick trip. Oh no, electricity is way cheaper than gas. So again, I feel like this is the right time for traditional automobile manufacturers and more technology-focused companies to really start looking at how to collaborate and build better products. I think this is going to be a very interesting showdown to see what branding and marketing can do for some of these entrenched labels, and can you create a new automobile in this space? Yeah, Dave Barnes, are you doing okay? That was very her. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm good. I did. I went full Daniel Tosh. It was really bad. See, Dave Burns, this is what I'm super jealous of. My neighborhood is super walkable, and I'm looking for full-time work from home positions. Like, that is absolutely the right play. Our neighborhood is lovely. We are tucked away in the hills in such a way where you've got to loop out of our little complex in one direction to then get to go in another direction. So like, for example, if I just want to go to a grocery store, there's a pretty straight walk that I can do to go to a grocery store, but you still got to like cut through a park, climb like this really nice, like garden path, then get out onto a major road, then walk down the major road, get to the grocery store. And if you get something cold, it's probably not going to be cold by the time you get it home. The direct line is super, super close. It's a very twisty path to get there. It is very suburban in that regard. So more often than not, well, let me just hop in the car. I've got a little electric scooter. I've really got to start using it more just for, hey, I need a bag's worth of groceries. Great. I can zip there like 10 miles an hour. That is so much better than if I'm, you know, turning on my gas-powered car to drive a tiny short distance. So yeah, it's silly, but even for us, the gas prices have definitely been starting to change our behavior.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
It's the Sony Play Wagon, Juan. That's a good one, Simon. I like that. I'm going to have to steal that from you. It's not the PlayStation, it's a Play Wagon. Are you going to play your PlayStation or your Play Wagon? I'm so clever. All right. Another one just to kind of keep our eyes on. Companies struggling financially. Every company is struggling financially right now. Profits have never been higher, but the stock market has never been less confident. Who thinks that we'll pull the trigger on official recession by the end of the month? Drop a one in the comments. Another... This is a report from Rest of World. I'm sorry. Let's just take this all over again. This is a report from restofworld.org looking at Netflix in an area that is heavily using Netflix. The streaming giant announced the new password sharing policy in Peru, in Chile, and in Costa Rica. So Central and South America represents Netflix's lowest revenue per user, making them particularly vulnerable to changes in pricing, according to the global media and entertainment research firm Ampere Analysis. So what we're seeing is these are the first areas that are undergoing the new household crackdown on password sharing for Netflix, where they're trying to encourage, like, if someone is sharing your account but doesn't really live in your, quote, household, then they need to start paying an additional $2 per month. So this is their sort of canary in the coal mine. This is their first test market, and it's not going particularly well. They're already facing some scrutiny because the policy hasn't been explained very clearly. What does Netflix consider a household? A community of people that all live together under one roof? Are we talking about families that might share data, but maybe they're separated by an address? They could be on the same wall, but they technically have different homes. This does kind of need to be buttoned down more clearly. Even in Netflix's own terms of service, I think this is loosely defined, even though I'm sure Netflix lawyers have a clear idea of what their legal limit might be. So we just got to keep an eye on this. This is eventually going to spread worldwide. And I know this is probably going to be the worst look for Netflix because they're the ones doing it first. But however this goes for Netflix is going to very clearly define this practice with every other streaming service. If you have password, if you're sharing your account on Disney Plus, like Disney Plus allows you to create multiple users under one pass or under one account. So like Netflix, I'm sure a lot of people out there are paying for one Disney Plus subscription and they have five users, and maybe not all of those users live under the same roof. Maybe some of them live in other parts of the country. As soon as Netflix kind of takes the brunt of the ire over this, I guarantee you, Disney Plus, HBO Max, Amazon Prime, they're all going to look at, well, what is our definition of a household? Oh, we don't want you to cancel your account, but, you know, Disney Plus, like if you add $1 a month, then you can keep that other user account going across the country. You don't have to pay for a whole new subscription. We're so magnanimous. We're Disney. When Netflix did the same thing and they got savaged for it by the media. If all of the reports are true, Netflix gives up a ton of data bandwidth to people who live outside of households or password sharing or all these other concerns. But they're only getting paid for one subscription fee. There is actually a long-term idea that Netflix could save on a lot of operation costs. It's a bad look for the company. I think a lot of people would consider leaving the service, but they're also not really making the money they should be for the number of folks that are actively using their service. It's really complicated when you start looking at interconnection fees, the number of data centers that Netflix needs to maintain, how they're making their own kind of internet backbone because they never really got support from carriers and ISPs. it's messy stuff. And it's actually kind of incredible that Netflix has made it this far as an independent company. Like, I really felt like they would have gotten bought out, absorbed, or acquired at some point earlier than now. So it's pretty messy. See, Gabaletta is already saying Disney Plus already randomly checks for password authentication to weed out password sharers. So I think that's one tactic. I bet you once Netflix brings this to the United States, suffers some subscriber loss, Disney Plus probably benefits from whatever Netflix loses almost directly, that they'll then have their own specific terms of service crackdown on what a household might be. So beyond just like, oh, well, occasionally we ask you to verify your password. Okay, cool. That's fine. We see that you've got a user in Los Angeles and a user in North Dakota. That can't be the same roof. That's what I think we're going to see, a more specific calling of people using those types of services. Dave Burns has kind of a longer comment here. I remember when a ton of newspapers and tech outlets were covering all the streaming services coming out, they declared the golden age of streaming was over and there was nothing we could do about it. Anyway, I don't know what people mean when they say news outlets manufacture our consent to things getting worse and us having no recourse. I just feel like now streaming is going to give us one advantage over cable. I think streaming is going to make it easier for us to say, I'm going to sign on to the service when there's a show I want to watch, and then I'm going to bounce, and later I'll pick it back up again when there's a show I want to watch. I think that's something for us, especially in our household, what with gas prices being so high, that I want to cycle more aggressively. I don't need to have Netflix all the time. I know I'm binging a lot of Knight Rider these days, just having it on in the background. I can find something else to have on in the background. But we're down to the 1080p stream. We stopped paying for the 4K. It made me really mad that you couldn't separate screens and resolution. Like, what I want to pay for is 4K for two screens, but Netflix won't give me that option. So we only need the two screens. So we went down to 1080p. Realized, like, I stream this mostly from mobile devices. I don't really get to watch my Netflix on the big, nice TV that often, and my daughter doesn't care about her kids' shows in 1080p. So we're good. I would be a bit more into the 4K and the quality and the experience. Plus, also on phones, there's no guarantee that the phone is going to play nice with Netflix's premium HDR. Have you guys noticed this? Okay, if you're having this problem like I did, so many of Netflix's, especially Netflix originals, are created in a flavor of HDR that doesn't really seem to translate well to the vast majority of phones. It's like, I think they're only kind of giving us the best version of that on Samsung and Apple. So you're watching something like Stranger Things and it's so dark. The image is so dim. And I might be on an iQOO or a Vivo or a OnePlus or a Moto or an LG, like my old V60, and I cannot see what's happening in the shot. It's like Game of Thrones, way too dark. It's like artificially dark. If you go in through a web browser, go into your user account and set your mobile streaming data to medium instead of the top tier or auto. So you don't want the highest quality. You set it down to medium, it doesn't send whatever HDR flavor they're sending, and suddenly the image is vibrant and colorful and detailed, and you can see everything that's going on. So I'm already not getting the bestest clarity data version of the Netflix stream. I had to reduce the quality just to see WTF is going on in that shot. Stranger Things was unwatchable in using the best quality settings through the Netflix app. So, but you can't do that in the Android app. You have to go to a browser, go into your user account settings, and disable the top quality settings from there. And if you're having issues with the content being too dark, give that a try, because that has radically changed. Now, like, all of my phones look amazing. doesn't matter what phone I'm on, I'm actually able to see what's happening. It's terrible. It's terrible. Yeah, and Gabaletta, Netflix is surprisingly good for kids. Yeah, we kind of let Lex just use her own account, and we've not run into too much. There was one like influencer high school cartoons that she was kind of watching, and it was awful. Like, it was all just a bunch of, like, shallow, big-headed, large-eyed, animated teen girls talking about being the mostest popular on the sharing social media. And, like, okay, no, she's not gonna... You can't watch that. That's a bad show. Almost everything else has been awesome. The science shows, Emily's Wonder Lab, Brainchild, I think, is one of the names of the shows. And then some of the game shows. Like, my daughter loves The Floor is Lava. She loves that show. Oh, also, we talked about Is It Cake? My daughter thought that was hilarious. So I'm fine letting her watch Is It Cake. But yeah, it's ridiculous. It's remarkably bad. the image quality. So Ted, it's beyond Widevine. Ted says, you got to pay attention to Widevine certifications when you're on Android. When it comes to Netflix, it's a hassle because the OEM doesn't allow it. It's not a Widevine issue. I have the highest tier. Widevine is a security protocol that allows for a higher tier of quality of streaming. If I have access to Netflix's top quality streaming option, that's not a Widevine certification issue. So I am getting the best quality Netflix can send. They aren't sending something that is broadly HDR compatible. It only kicks on whatever flavor of HDR on certain approved phones, regardless of that security certification. And if you're running into that issue on another phone, like a Motorola, a OnePlus, or a Google, which shows that they are Widevine, what is it, Widevine level one, then the only way that you can get the true clarity and color and representation of that image is to go down a quality level through the Netflix quality settings. Oh, yeah, seriously. I couldn't read the name. From Ken Not Kaneki, I believe that's how you say your name. I can't watch Jack. I'm on Pixel because of how bad it gets, specifically on Netflix. I'll give it a shot. So first, check your independent brightness meter, because Netflix is so stupid for using a different brightness setting than your phone. But then from there, drop down to medium. Medium quality on a phone screen looks fantastic, and you should get all of the color data because it's not a funky HDR setting. Okay, I had one bit of news. Like, I can just kind of read this off. I don't need to editorialize too much. There's a T-Mobile press release saying that T-Mobile advances standalone 5G capabilities with commercial launch of voice over 5G. Just something to keep an eye on. We're into the 5G transition proper. T-Mobile has their ultra capacity. Verizon has their millimeter wave. We're getting some of the faster 5G out to more areas. But one of the things that's going to be very interesting to watch, voice over LTE was kind of a big deal. So your voice is basically a data call now. Basically, phone is just another piece of data on your pocket computer. As we push more voice over 5G, I think we'll start to see an accelerated ramp towards devaluing LTE, the proper 4G connections, and making 5G more and more of a priority. This is when we really start to see that transition where, when you see LTE on your phone's bars at the top of the screen, where even if you've got all the bars, that your quality of network performance is going to degrade. Same thing happened when we went from 3G to 4G. As soon as LTE started really adopting more and more user bases, people were flipping their phones and getting newer devices, even if you had a stable 3G signal, you were not getting the best 3G that you could. You know, there was a time where 3G and 4G overlap was remarkably close. As LTE picked up more adopters, 3G was devalued. And I think the same thing is going to start happening to LTE probably over the next year. So when we see that T-Mobile is ahead of the curve on voice over 5G, VO5G, then we can assume this is the beginning of LTE being devalued for all future network upgrades and improvements. And I think we just want to keep an eye on it. But over the next year, if you've got family and friends who are on older LTE phones that are still properly supported, if you hear that they're starting to complain about network performance or network issues, I think this is the time frame we need to be watching more closely. Well, yeah, Dave Burns, I mean, that would be really helpful. Dave writes, if all these phones are using Samsung AMOLED panels, I don't know how there isn't a standardized API for HDR tech. And so many of them rank these like HDR 10, HDR 10 plus, like all of these like certifications and stuff don't seem to matter. It's really frustrating. Oh no. from Farhan, in my country, not all telcos support voice over LTE. So whenever someone with voice over LTE calls me, the call quality sucks. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. That's rough. Oh, and Dave Burns also. So LTE greater than 4G, greater than 5G, because it wasn't feasible to install full-fledged 4G everywhere. Marketing for this is bad. And Ken Not Kaneki, most Android flagships support HDR 10 plus. I mean, you see it listed in the spec sheets and the certifications, so you'd think. I don't understand what Netflix is doing, unless there's some other issue like the top quality option is using a codec or a compression that when you then also go through the HDR process is resulting in not properly displaying the full dynamic range of the shot. Is this a codec issue? We know that Qualcomm SoCs to date haven't been properly decoding different codecs, right? So maybe that's it. I don't know. It drives me crazy. I hate seeing my reflection in my phone screen brighter than the video. But we're getting to the end of the news block. And we absolutely need to highlight the major political win. New York State passes first electronics right to repair bill. Written up by Sharon Harding over at Ars Technica. The fight for right to repair scored a huge win Friday with New York State passing a bill that requires digital electronics manufacturers like laptop and smartphone manufacturers to make diagnostic and repair information available to consumers and independent repair shops. More specifically, the bill says it requires OEMs to make available for purposes of diagnosis, maintenance, or repair to any independent repair provider or to the owner of digital electronic equipment manufactured by or on behalf of or sold by the OEM on fair and reasonable terms, documentation, parts, and tools, inclusive of any updates to information. Nothing in this section requires an OEM to make available a part if the part is no longer available to the OEM. For equipment that contains an electronic security lock or other security-related function, the OEM shall make available to the owner and to the independent repair provider on fair and reasonable terms any special documentation, tools, and parts needed to access and reset the lock or function when disabled in the course of diagnosis, maintenance, or repair of the equipment. Such documentation, tools, and parts may be made available through appropriate secure release systems. Okay, that was a lot. Major critical victory. Proper documentation so that we know what's going on inside the electronic device. Parts where parts are available. This is one of the major issues with Apple. We know that they are working with their component suppliers to make sure no one else can buy those components. So Apple has kind of a stranglehold locking out anyone else from buying those parts and pieces. And that last bit, most critical, if you are serializing the parts or if you are locking repairs to a specific piece of software, you need to make that in some way available to consumers. I love to plug his channel. I really should have pulled up the video that he recently posted, but I need everyone to watch Hugh Jeffries. Hugh Jeffries recently took a look at the Apple Repair Kit, and the parts and components that you get with the repair kit really aren't the issue. I know there were a whole bunch of, again, I'm going to do my bad Daniel Tosh here. Apple sent me this huge block. It weighed like so much, and all I needed to do was replace this really lightweight component. So anyone who writes stuff like that is an utter and inane hack. Like, they're, again, I'm going to say, they're terrible at technology. They should never have a voice or a platform. They're bad at tech, and they should just go away. We need to stop rewarding dumb people in this commentary space with attention, because the outrage attention profits them just as much as the positive attention. We need to only reward through positive application of going to people who put out good information. If you've seen someone write an editorial about this Apple repair kit is so weird because it came with something heavy, never go to their website ever again. Set up a rule in your browser, you know, set up a rule on Reddit. Eliminate them from your feed. Stop giving them clicks so that they can stop profiting as much from being raving idiot assholes on the internet. Okay? There's a dude named Hugh Jeffries who is making some of the best, most well-considered, most consistent tech information on the internet today as it relates to repairing gadgets. And he took a look at the Apple Repair Kit. His opinion on the Apple Repair Kit is a billion times more valuable to the conversation than all of the asshats, the people who literally wear their asses as hats, could ever hope to approach if their first take was, but everything is heavy. Just stooge slap all the way down the line for anyone who really did an editorial like that. You're awful, and I don't like your commentary. And you need to go sit down and think about what you've done. I digress. Hugh Jeffries broke down this Apple repair kit, and the parts, components, everything was actually pretty good. The documentation for the repairs were solid. The block that helps you seat the phone, absolutely a great piece of hardware that the actual Apple geniuses would probably be using too. If you want to conduct this repair correctly, then you should be looking at using the same types of tools that the actual Apple geniuses are using when they do their repairs. All of this is on point. The tricky part for the Apple repair program was still going through a certification process where you can't really finish the repair unless you spend a significant amount of time with an Apple genius going through and resetting the phone software in a very specific way, which has to be done very carefully over your computer through an Apple genius's computer to reserialize all of those components. And for Hugh, swapping a bunch of things and switching back and forth between two different iPhones and looking at the different parts, he basically locked out one of his phones. And they could not finish the repair properly through that Apple Genius software handoff in reserializing all of those parts. So Apple's software is actually one of the key actions that the New York State Right to Repair legislation is aiming at. It doesn't matter if you can get a new screen for your phone and replace it yourself, if plugging that screen in, even if it's a certified part, is going to brick your phone. Oh no, now a whole bunch of things don't work because I didn't have an Apple Genius sitting right next to me with a very special proprietary software tool to verify the screen's software and get the serial number to match on my phone. And that's the most insidious part of Apple claiming that they're all about repair and longevity and the environment, because that critical step is missing. the convenience of that step where you could take this into your own hands and do the repair or give it to an independent repair shop, they can't do that for you. In fact, this Apple repair program kind of precludes, you're not really going to be allowed to use a repair shop. Even if you can get the part to them, they have to do all of this work re-serializing the parts too. And that's going to take significant amounts of time. I want to say Hugh Jeffrey said this whole process took hours and still failed. So no repair technician at a third-party shop is going to sit there for 90 minutes waiting for a little line on a graph to finish sliding over and then go, oh, well, we couldn't finish it. I guess, you know, got to take it into an Apple store. That's not a thing. So New York State making it a part of a law to say that there needs to be a good faith effort where you can not only get the parts, not only get the documentation, but you also have access to the tools that will properly activate the components in your device is massive. And that's also going to have some, I think, rippling effects for things like the farming industry, what John Deere has been doing with tractors. You know, like once we can kind of get around the idea of locking components to these kinds of software tools, I think we actually do have just a crowbar, just a little bit of leverage where we can change some of this consumer relationship with our devices. They don't necessarily need to be completely glued shut and disposable, and that's a huge net positive for how we use all of this tech. So sorry, I am way behind on the chat. Yeah, Dave Burns, I don't get it, man. How did Luddites become tech influencers? It really is like, well, lots of people like Apple, so we'll just keep telling people to keep liking Apple and we'll make more money that way. And anyone who's like, I don't know about this repair program, you should just take your phone to a Genius Bar, instead of like, I don't know about this repair program, maybe this means you should stop buying Apple. Like, if this is the solution they came up with and it bothers you, the solution isn't keep buying more Apple and having less choice for your repair or sourcing components. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And the thing is, like, it's criticizing the wrong part. Because I'm actually very positive on the Apple repair kits. I am viciously critical of Apple's repair strategy involving an overly complicated software dance. That is not okay. But for techies, journalists, to be like, I needed to replace a light component, but they sent a heavy repair kit. Idiots. Raving idiots. Yeah, Farhan, that's exactly what I did with YouTube. Thank God for the little don't recommend this channel feature. Dustadore, some stooge slapping guy. And Aditya, yes, absolutely. The reserialization kind of takes away from the repairability from the user, doesn't it? It absolutely does, which is why we apparently need to make a law. So again, if you would like to see this process evolve and you'd like to see more reasonable, eventually build a federal standard of right to repair, take a second and write your local elected officials. I'm going to send a letter to my senator and say, hey, we just saw what happened in New York. I mean, sorry, I'm going to write a letter to my state senator and say, California needs something like this too. We've been working on, I think, a similar piece of legislation. I'm mad that New York beat us to the punch. And so now it's time to kind of just apply a little light pressure. You've got my vote. I'm anxious to see what you can do. Let's really get this conversation rolling here, too. Yep, TED Talks Tech, way to go, New York. I'm very excited to see this pass. Again, there's so much lobbying. Apple spent so much money fighting this kind of legislation. It's good. This is the kind of market correction that Apple's been overdue. Yeah, Gormlord. This is accurate too. I also saw in a video that getting replacement parts from Apple costs as much or more than taking it into Apple to get repaired. So there, I do not believe that the Apple repair program is being conducted in good faith. They are making these things available to consumers so that they can claim they're on the right side of right to repair. But at the same time, there are business practices at play where if you take your phone to an Apple Genius and you've got Apple Care and you can you know, pay the whatever little subsidy for getting the repair done, it's going to be often significantly cheaper to go take it to an Apple store. So how does that work financially? If the part costs a certain amount of money and the labor is a certain amount of cost, how can the part and the labor at a Genius bar be lower than just the part by itself? So Apple is playing some games. They're not really doing this in good faith. They're doing this for the optics and all the real positive headlines and all the thumbs up from, oh yeah, Apple and the environment and stuff. And it's not real. Again, like so much of what Apple's current business model is, it's marketing and it's optics. And that's fine. They're $2 trillion, almost $3 trillion company. That's how you get to almost $3 trillion, right? But if we want things to get better, then they're due a market correction. And a part of that is also the psychology of how we talk about a brand that heavily leans into the feel goods in their ads and is built on bullying. Like, part of what makes Apple so profitable is how they bully developers, how they bully competitors, and how they bully their own users. And if we're okay with that, then cool. Keep giving your money to bullies. But that's what Apple has become. From Trey, I had to explain a right to repair to my wife's friend just Saturday because we were talking about soft serve McFlurry machines. it hits people. Everybody's going to have their own like trigger, like the light switch click, you know? And if it's something as simple as like, but I just wanted some soft serve, you know, like, then do it. Right to repair is affecting you too. And you can't get your soft serve. Please support this legislation. I love it. All right. Quick shout out for the subreddit for so much news. I think I did okay getting through this. Every podcast has a subreddit. Mine is no exception. This is the first week where I think we saw a noticeable dip in submissions, in activity. We didn't lose any members or subscribers or followers, but we didn't grow that significantly. Over the last 2 weeks, I have not been able to give the subreddit as much attention. And it kind of shows when I'm not leading a lot of chatter and sharing a ton of submissions from it, that the subreddit can sometimes suffer from me going on autopilot. I'm going to put it out there again. If you care about a broader conversation in tech, supporting tech creators and commentators who deserve more attention and getting outside of the echo chamber trap of only Samsung and Apple are worth talking about ever, then reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles needs your help. I'm not just sitting here to pat myself on the back and talk about how great my own subreddit is. This is an actual labor of love to spread as much awareness and as much attention as we can generate for people that are always going to struggle under the boot heel of the algorithm. And right now, this is the most precious time we've seen, you know, where viewership numbers are down. People are starting to write like funky editorials on major YouTube tech channels. Oh, their viewership is down too. They're not getting the views. Whatever is happening in this conversation, if you care about it and if you want to see others grow and succeed and get this entertaining and this fun conversation and this fun content, it can't be enough just to kind of passively consume it and say, hey, that was a neat video, and then just go on with your day. Literally clicking a little up arrow is help for search engine optimization. It's helpful for discovery. You go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangle and just click. I like it. 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 And even that is a benefit. That is like the bare minimum amount of effort someone can extend to help another creator continue producing content. And I've got, you know, 25, I'm showing like 25 people are in this stream right now. And literally, if I saw 25 upvotes on a single video, that would have been the top video of last week. That's it. I mean, that's the kind of numbers we're swinging with here. So the top stories, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangle. I'm excited because my part two video on the Vivo X80 Pro was the top video of last week. But immediately after that, @8893... which I believe Farhan is in the chat right now. Number two submission, new LG V60 feature, 8K manual mode. It's not over yet. LG V60 is still one of the best built phones of all time. I mean, you're not seeing these kinds of recap videos on major YouTube channels. Here's Easy Computer Solutions. Eric has been rocking my socks on his long-term LG coverage because these phones have been awesome. And then number three, Tech Alter, why phone batteries aren't getting better. This is a great, insightful, well put together editorial on a part of tech that is huge. You know, the swing, 12 upvotes, 11 upvotes, 10 upvotes. That's it. I got 12 clicks on that Vivo X80 Pro. Eric got 10 clicks, 10 votes. I see people in the chat. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Content that needs your attention, content that needs your support. Supporting this and sharing this and sharing from the subreddit could also bring some eyeballs to the project, getting more comments, getting more interactions. All of that is what fuels discoverability. If you like this stuff, it will not survive. I mean, seriously, at no other point in my career, like I've been making videos on the internet since 2007. At no other point in my career have I seen more people rebranding, shifting their strategies, or outright just walking away. Do you want your favorite, you know, medium-sized and smaller channels to just walk away? You gotta show them that you're in it. And I'm trying to contribute to that with this little subreddit. Other ways that you can do it directly, but do something. You know, if you liked a video, you were enjoying some content, and then you're like, oh yeah, that guy hasn't made videos in a while. Well, that's going to become increasingly more common. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Go check it out. Please share the subreddit, participate, support it. Do whatever you can, because these are people that are really putting their own effort, their own blood, sweat, and tears, and often their own sweat equity. Because I guarantee you, a dude like Eric is not getting the bills paid on his YouTube, but that dude makes so many videos, and they're always fun to watch. They're always a blast. So, Dustadore, I keep forgetting that I made a Reddit account super late to the party. I know. How about this? I will help support people that make the subreddit a game. Ted used to be amazing at this, but I know his work and life and photography balance changed up. But he used to do a daily recap. Like he would just tweet, oh, the top video of the day on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles was this. Go give him a shout, give him some support. And I always try to make an effort to retweet that. Anyone who wants to incorporate that kind of conversation, you want to tweet about it, you want to share it on some other social media platform, Instagram, whatever, let me know, and I am happy to also give that a nudge and give it a share. But if the subreddit is just me talking about my own subreddit, then the subreddit's probably not going to survive. I'm also always interested in if someone is really serious about being a moderator for the subreddit, and helping keep up with some of the daily work, if submissions are getting spam filtered, or if someone is trying to scam. We did see a scammer on the subreddit 3 weeks ago that I had to take care of personally. Let me know. I'm always happy to entertain some of those conversations. It's supposed to be a community. It's supposed to be actual grassroots. It's not just me spending all of my time trying to tell people that other people make good stuff on the internet too. If it's not a value, then I'll walk away. Like, that's part of it. I've got a lot to occupy my time, and it's tough. But I know for a fact that there are a couple of smaller channels that helped get their nudge because one of their posts got popular on Glowing Rectangles and from there was shared to other larger subreddits. That's exactly what we need to see. You know, if something takes the top spot for a week on this subreddit, it is so much more likely that it's going to get shared on a much, much larger platform. And from there, that video is going to get a ton of traffic. And then that content creator is going to get a ton of insight into what makes an audience, you know, interested. And from there, they can make some even better content moving forward. So that's the plea. We can get into the gadget block here. I'm going to take a quick drink of water. Discuss.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processes and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Anantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutress and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humor, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
Whoa, man, I was dry. You take that drink of water and, like, you can feel your throat unclench. Whew! I was definitely, a little dehydrated there. All right, just some quick, actually, you know what? These aren't so quick. I'm not going to say quick. I hope I can get through them efficiently. Let's say that. First of all, I'm a big old nerd for the Steam Deck. Steam Deck dock is delayed. So Valve put out a press release. Excuse me. Due to shortages and COVID closures at our manufacturing facilities, the official Steam Deck docking station is delayed. We're working on improving the situation. We'll share more info when we have it. In the meantime, the team is continuing to work on improving the docked experience for Steam Deck with all USB-C hubs and external displays. Literally everything I've plugged into the Steam Deck has worked as a dock. So like I've got, you know, just an inexpensive laptop hub. It worked great. I've got another laptop hub coming that's a really nice, like, it looks like it's supposed to be built for a Mac Mini. But it's just a general USB-C dock. I'm really hoping that works, because I think it's nice. Like, if you want to spend a little bit more, you can and arrive at, like, a really nice solution, even for something like a Steam Deck. So I'm really stoked. So far, everything has been awesome. Like, I'm playing with... I want to show it off now. YouPerfect sent over another one of their... this is the YouPerfect X Pro. It's the 15-inch display. When I reviewed it originally, they had only started making the 1080p version. And I want to say the original launch price was something like... It was, like, over $500. So this, they sent a new one. It's the one that has the little keyboard blade. This is so hard for me to hold up and show on camera. And the keyboard blade hasn't changed significantly. Like, it's still pretty good. It's still okay. It still has issues where if you're scooching it around, like, this magnetic connection can sometimes disconnect the pins from the monitor. But this is the 4K version, and it's now under $500. So if you want a 15-inch monitor, portable monitor, 4K display, I'm making up numbers here, and it's battery powered and has a built-in USB-C hub so that you can connect other devices or plug in an HDMI cable. It connects directly to the Steam Deck, like USB-C cable directly over. This is battery powered. It hooks right up and it trickle charges the Steam Deck while you play. I don't think there is anything that exists sub $500 for a 4K touchscreen with a battery built in that is this beautifully considered. I mean, it's just shockingly thin on that leading edge. I mean, that's just ridiculous. This is like, I think it's 2/3 the thickness of my WiMAXit portable monitor. And I just got to show this off because I'm a big old nerd. This won't affect my reviewing or my opinion of the company, but it was such a lovely gesture that the folks at YouPerfect branded it for me. So this is the YouPerfect Some Gadget Guy edition of the 4K display. And that's just cute. So when it shows up in a video, they're like, okay, it's the YouPerfect label for Some Gadget Guy. That was really nice. So I'm really digging this. The keyboard still could use a little bit of work, but the display is excellent. Like, it's awesome. So that's actually what I'm going to be using when we jump back in with the Moto, because the Moto Edge Plus can natively put out a 4K desktop in Ready 4. So Ready 4 has native support for 4K monitors. It looks really good, but it's terrible video if I'm just trying to show you my 4K desktop monitor, because this is just not a good shot. Like, I can't make this shot looking at my desk look very good, but now I can show 4K a lot better switching over to a 4K 4K display. So the YouPerfect is going to come in handy very, very soon on a couple of videos that I'm looking to put together. Yeah, Dave, I mean, again, I want to pick up a YouPerfect so badly. I really like having sort of a laptop style dock. It's so handy for so many uses. So if it's more of like a traditional clamshell and it flips all the way around, you can prop up that monitor. This 15 inch is a bit big. You know, it's a little bit bigger. You're going to try and cart it around, but it's still beautifully flexible, wonderfully functional. Let me get this out of the way here. Yeah, and DTNL, now I've got a limited edition piece of hardware. So Steam Deck, not getting the official dock. So far, everything else has worked fine. The last major update for the Steam Deck basically took away all of those concerns that I had that, oh, maybe I need to get the dock. I don't think I'm going to buy the dock now. It's really just been totally fine on its own. So lastly, for tech conversations, I want to show this again. I'm not going to show the video, but I just want to highlight, first of all, go watch that Hugh Jeffries video on the Apple repair kit. Beautifully insightful. You can also follow that up with the folks at iFixit. One of the next major conversations to be had in Android land is what's going to happen with the mid-year refresh for Qualcomm for the new Snapdragon. And I kind of teased this at the beginning of the podcast, but my buddy Dr. Ian of Tech Potato fame, he got to go to a Qualcomm office, I think. But he is checking out, and he got to do a whole bunch of performance testing on the Snapdragon 8 Plus Gen 1. I feel like this video is going to have some issues with discoverability, because the name of the video is, quote, extracting 30% better performance per watt on 4 nanometers. But nowhere in there does it say Qualcomm, Snapdragon, 8 Gen 1, anything. But in true Dr. Ian fashion, he used to be one of the editors at Anantech. He breaks down a whole bunch of performance testing looking at not just outright performance, but also power efficiency. And some of these Qualcomm claims seem to be holding true. So earlier in the year, and I've got a bunch of 8 Gen 1s on my desk, the 8 Gen 1 can be a very good performer if it's managed and thermally handled properly. Samsung did not get it done this year. And especially when I pick up like a Vivo, an IQ, or some of these other devices, even a OnePlus, I feel is handled more appropriately. Then there's the other flavor of this, where there are some phones like the Motorola where You just need to be a bit present on how you're using it, but it will rise to the occasion. The Moto Edge Plus is handily one of the best performing phones I've ever tested, I've ever used, but that also comes at the cost of occasionally you can nuke your battery if you're really hitting it hard, right? Ditto with Sony. Like, Sonys don't really seem to throttle down or hold back much, but then they're going to run warm to the touch and you can evaporate your battery. This is what we're anxious about. I do not like the name 8 Plus Gen 1. That is going to be so difficult to make video titles for. I can kind of understand why Tech Potato sort of bounced off of, you know, putting 8 Plus Gen 1 in a video title on YouTube. But through Dr. Ian's performance testing, I'm not going to spoil the exact numbers and stuff. Go watch his video, because again, he breaks down what the situation is like today. He breaks down why it's interesting to see Qualcomm shift. They did Samsung fabrication at the beginning of the year, and they're going to do TSMC fabrication at the end of the year. And then he gets into some of his performance numbers and some of his battery measurements. And it's brilliant. I have a much better understanding of what's going on. And it does seem that moving from Samsung chip fab to TSMC is bringing a noticeable bump in efficiency. Now, I'm sure Qualcomm has adjusted and refined some of the design of the 8 Gen 1, but also a major component of this seems to be TSMC's more mature fabrication techniques over what Samsung was trying to accomplish with the 8 Gen 1. So we should definitely be on the lookout for phones in the second half of the year that have 8 Plus Gen 1 chips, as they don't seem to be radically better performers in a number of CPU and GPU tasks. Like, we're seeing some improvements. It's not just the same performance. There are some bumps in performance, but it's not so impressive. CPU compute power, whoa, 15% better. It's more, can we arrive at maybe a tiny CPU compute power bump, but then save 20% battery? And that, I think, is actually going to be way more critical for users out there, that if they're using their phone, and they're using their phone to a higher degree, can they get 10% more life out of it? 10% more runtime, 20% more runtime. Those would be very encouraging numbers, motivating a purchasing decision if I were looking at the end of this year and I had some good comparable options between like a Vivo X80 Pro and something else with comparable camera performance, but I got like 20% better runtime out in the field. That could work. That would be good. So I feel like this is still a total chain issue. ARM has reference designs for these new processing cores. Qualcomm has their own configuration of how these cores are supposed to operate. And then the final step is who fabricated that chip. Just looking at a Qualcomm reference device, moving the fabrication from Samsung to TSMC seems to have improved this performance per watt situation. And for real information and for a real breakdown on how all of that works, go check out Tech Potato. This video is not climbing in views like I think it deserves to. It is a prime candidate for reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. So this is good stuff. This is definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on. Simon says Hypno, but does it have a goofy thumbnail? No, it's just him holding the chip. No, this is the thumbnail. Like, again, I respect this. You know, that is a functional thumbnail, but again, I don't get to make those decisions. Now the YouTube algorithm will actively harm videos that don't have someone making a wacky goofy face. Yeah, Farhan, absolutely. Farhan writes, it seems like ZTE got it right with the Nubia's built-in cooling fan. Yeah, if you can move more air through the phone or dispel more heat, that 8 Gen 1 is capable of some astonishing performance. the reality of building a phone that has to be all sealed up and somewhat water resistant, that's a different kind of challenge. And I don't believe, like, I believe Samsung gets it right with the Note 22. I don't believe they got it right with the S22. I think they cut too many corners. Gormlord, man, if a company released new phones with an 865, snatch it up so fast, I'd stick with that forever. Where did I put it? Is it not on my desk anymore? Oh, I think it's behind me. Ugh. Let me see. Well, Gormlord, may I introduce you to the Vivo iQ Neo 6. This is rocking a Snapdragon 870. A Snapdragon 870 is basically a plus version of the 865. So we saw the 865 Plus in the Note 20 Ultra. That was a nice little, just a little bump, kind of a better binning, slightly better clock speeds. And the 870 is just the next step of that. This is basically a nicer version of an 865, $450, 12 gigabytes of RAM, 4 gigabytes of extended swap space, and 256 gigs of storage for $450. 120 hertz refresh rate OLED with HDR 10 plus support. So you know your Netflix will be super dark and unwatchable unless you tell Netflix to send you less data. And a reasonably proficient main camera sensor. My first look video is available on youtube.com/JuanBagnell, or you can search for some gadget guy. But the 870, the 865 is still going strong today. It is a beautiful performer. Yeah, exactly, Gabaletta. While Samsung is not a small company and they are not new to this chip fabrication, having more competition is still better than no competition at all. So while Samsung is somehow still dropping the ball on making SoCs, it's still beneficial for them to stay in the space to keep competition going. I completely agree. And I don't think they're going anywhere. I think they announced they're going to be dropping something like $20 billion on their next stage of chip fabrication. So yeah, again, we're not losing Samsung. I think they're going to rebrand the Exynos probably over the next year or two. They're still the driving force on Tensor. So Tensor 2 is going to be built on a Samsung manufacturing process. It's, you know, we're going to see this play out over a longer period of time. We're getting into 1040. I've got two things that I want to point out here. One is a post on Reddit and the other is a question from the Patreon. And then we can, I don't mind going a little over this week's podcast, just kind of catching up on all the news. And I still want to talk about this Moto and this TCL, but I just wanted to highlight this post on the LG Wing subreddit, because this is what I talk about when I'm complaining about how terrible tech reviewers have been for educating their audience on things like camera tech. They really don't have any business talking about cameras and overly simplifying how these things work. Like, if you're an enthusiast and you really care about all these numbers, then it's on us to really demonstrate this is what the camera really does. This is just marketing speech. So this is on the... someone in the comments, as I start reading from this article post... tell me where you think this individual might have been led astray. LG Wing subreddit, anyone else get ripped off by Verizon for the Verizon version of the LG Wing? I've had eight. This individual has had eight LG Wings. Okay? Eight LG Wings. Back to the article. Back to the Reddit post. They're all missing the 12 megapixel, and the supposed 64 megapixel is only 16 megapixels on this model. The 32 megapixel pop-up is a measly 8 megapixels. Need everyone else to send their specs. Other models help immensely as well. Anyone got any feelings, any thoughts on what might be happening with this person here? I love this. The supposed 64 megapixels is only 16. Yep, Simon says Hypno, absolutely correct. If we divide all those numbers by 4... And a detail. Oh, dang. Man, lost them pickles when binned. And Dave Burns. Yep, pixel binning down. So the poor person doesn't realize that the sensor's binned down. So this is what I've been... I mean, if you've been watching my videos and streaming and sort of following some of these camera conversations, we can advertise 108 megapixels. Isn't that so incredible? Then you divide by 9 and it's a 12 megapixel sensor, right? 64, divide by 4, you get 16. 48, divide by 4, you get 12. 50 megapixels, divide by 4, you get 12.5. It's a 12.5 megapixel sensor. What's more important is the larger surface area. 4 pixels becoming 1 is the standard resolution of that camera. When you shoot a RAW file, you do not get a 108 megapixel RAW file because that would look really funky. You would have nine red pixels all in a block, then 9 green subpixels all in a block. The JPEG works at 108 because they're doing a bunch of fancy demosaicing to try and swap pixels around. Can't do that with the RAW file. It's RAW. So the RAW file sits at the binned pixel resolution. This person has been through... Eight LG Wings on Verizon trying to get that mythical LG Wing that really does have the 64 megapixels. So this is the disservice that we're doing to less informed consumers when we overly simplify these kinds of metrics. Like, I'm on embargo for another phone, and it took a long time to get good data out of their PR. Just like, what kind of camera sensor is this? Because they're blocking. I mean, this is like a prototype unit. It's early access. They're blocking the data from those apps that can kind of look at what's going on with the camera. And they're like, oh, well, it's so many megapixels. That doesn't tell me anything. I can put 108 megapixels on a tiny sensor. That's irrelevant. What I need to know is, what's the pixel size? What's the sensor size? Is it 108 megapixels on a 1 over 1.3 inch sensor? That's super exciting. Is it 64 megapixels on a 1 over 2.5 inch sensor? That's not exciting. That's actually not great. That's maybe bad. Maybe we shouldn't do that. So this is the problem. We're sharing bad data, or we're oversimplifying data to the point where it's not only meaningless, but it's distracting and sends the wrong impression on what these things can actually do. Gormlord, again, it's impossible not to walk away from that as an interaction and not be like, yeah, that's kind of sad. That's a person who is devoted a not insignificant amount of time to harassing Verizon staff, and they could have just been enjoying that phone this whole time, because the LG Wing is still a beast of a camera phone. Like, I mean, it was up until, like, I was kind of rocking the Pixel 6 Pro for a while, and the Vivo X70 Pro Plus. The LG Wing was still in the mix as my main B-roll camera. I mean, it was awesome, especially when I kind of, like, I need to kind of go easy on my V60 because I want to keep my V60 around in good condition for as long as I can. The LG Wing sort of stepped up as my, maybe I'll abuse it a bit more, camera phone. I don't know. It just makes me frustrated because that's someone who really didn't need to do all of that. And like I said, could have just been enjoying the phone for what it was. It's really such a shame. Yeah, because it's not an iPhone, so they don't have the marketing material to sort it out. I'm shocked that like the Verizon people are also going like, hey, there's nothing wrong with this phone. And then not being able to point out to this individual, like, there's a reason why this presents the data the way that it does. It just sucks. From Dave Burns, is this the part where I channel my inner libertarian and say it's this person's fault for not doing their own research and becoming a phone enthusiast before analyzing all the data and reporting on this phone to realize what the actual message is? I can't blame them, though, because where would they go for the information? We're talking about a marketplace of ideas. I don't know that one works. So this kind of leads into the question that I got on Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. And it was on my OnePlus video. The OnePlus 10 Pro is good, but it's nothing special. I think a lot of people on the Patreon were willing to go with me on my silly little editorial clickbaity title. I know I got a number of comments on the YouTube. Well, I don't care if you don't think it's special. I love my OnePlus 10 Pro. And like I had to like, well, we're playing the game of who really watched the video and who's just reacting to the video title. But it seemed to work because I got some engagement on that video. And I hate that that's how it works these days. But Peter on the Patreon wrote, side question, do you think the democratization of photography has distilled it as an art form? It seems like anyone can be a photographer these days because a lot of the heavy lifting is done for you via AI magic. Not sure myself how I feel on the topic. Part of me feels that any art form should take hard work to master or fully understand. What are your thoughts? And I kind of appreciate where this question is coming from. Peter is asking something that I've definitely seen echoed in a number of camera-centric forums and conversations. And it's one where I am always excited to see the potential disruption of a hobby or an industry that has significant gatekeeping. So when I was a kid, my very first experiences with cameras were on film. Like I had like one of those little clicky, what was the film? Like the 110 cartridges that you would put in. And if you wanted a flash, you would have to get flash cubes. So like every time you would hit the shutter, the flash would go and you'd smell like that acrid chemical smell. That was really expensive. Even for having a really simple plasticky basic camera, every shot was like, I was spending 50 cents, you know, back in late 80s, early 90s money. So when I got into high school, my first experiences with nice, proper photography, it was stepping up from these little plasticky or single-use cameras. We used to have disposable cameras. But my first experiences with gooder photography, they were still film. When we made the transition to digital cameras, there was all of this gnashing of teeth. Digital's never going to completely replace film. Film is here to stay. The image quality of film, the texture, the character. And also, film is more expensive. And because film is more expensive, it's going to keep the true artistry of the craft. And we're not going to have to, you know, suffer all of these poorer digital representations of scenes. Those who really understand what they're doing and have spent the money, the gatekeeping always seems to come down to money. I spent more money learning how to shoot on film and develop film and print film. So that's where the art is. And this digital stuff, it's not going to replace film, not for the real, you know, the true artists. Well, that's not true anymore. Digital is a fine replacement for film. You know, I never really felt like I was so precious about film that I needed to keep shooting on film. When I could afford to switch over to a digital Canon, I went over to digital and I was good. I still have my Canon 7D. It's in the closet right now. That's a 10-year-old digital camera. I feel like I've more than gotten my money's worth on that shooter, and it's still fun to take out and shoot on today. It's a 10-year-old digital, 12-year-old now, DSLR. So the same thing is kind of happening again with phone cameras, in my opinion. Something like a night mode on the Vivo beautifully democratizes a difficult camera setup. If it's really dark and you're in challenging conditions, how do you get a brighter image? A proper photographer is going to set up their camera, maybe employ some flashes or some other type of expensive lighting, and they're going to go for a longer exposure or a bracketed exposure, and then that needs to be edited and composited and produced so that it's the nice clear image that you want to get at the end of this process. And that's all hard work. That's all the craft and all the artistry. And doesn't a night mode cheapen that experience? And I don't really think it does. You can take a crummy night photo shot. You know, if your composition is terrible and your subject isn't properly focused on, you're not lining up the shot the way that you see it, and you're not finishing off the shot, maybe a night mode photo still needs a little bit of post or editing. No amount of better gear or artistry and craft are going to improve that photo. Just because I made the night mode composite easier doesn't change the amount of education and talent and artistry that goes into good composition. I guess I should say it that way. Just because I simplified the process of stacking images in a bracket and making an HDR photo doesn't change. If you don't have an eye for good composition, your photo is still going to be garbage. It's going to be bright, vivid HDR garbage, but it's still going to be garbage. The only thing that's changed is that democratizing of some of the labor on the back end of stacking those shots and editing in Photoshop and producing in Lightroom, that all just got a little simpler. It didn't make someone a better photographer. It maybe makes them a better editor. And we actually went into this with VoiceOver quite a bit. I would audition talent, and when they would send in an audition, the audition would be amazing. And then I'd get them in the booth, and they could barely read their way out of a paper bag. That person was not a good VoiceOver artist. They were an incredible VoiceOver editor. And I don't have the time to let someone read through a script a whole bunch of times to try and pick out pieces of it that can then be edited together to make a nice product. A good VoiceOver performer can read and deliver, and then I don't have to do as much editing. So you're definitely at conflict in what people are trying to expect. And I think photography is very similar. So my feeling is anything that democratizes and gets better tools into people's hands means that there's a greater likelihood that we'll find the next generation of great photographers. They're just going to start with phones. Anyone who really takes the time to master a phone camera and get incredible shots out of a phone camera and understand composition and understand exposure and know that they're working on a warped version of the exposure triangle, that person is going to be an amazing photographer no matter what camera they choose to pick up, because it's all about the composition and understanding how light works. Working with the constraints of a phone camera is still learning about photography concepts and composition. If you take someone who is absolutely terrible at phone photography and you give them a DSLR or a mirrorless camera, then their output's probably going to be worse because they won't have all the AI tools to hold their hands, you know? So I really appreciated where Peter was kind of coming from this question. And I really feel it's, again, it's another example, or it's incumbent on us to look at why we gatekeep. Why does it matter that someone invested thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars into a mirrorless camera system? If the only thing they really have to show for it is, like, I can shoot a fetishistically shallow depth of field, isn't that such amazing photography? And you're like, it's really not. It's shallow, and so it looks kind of interesting and cinematic, but that doesn't mean that your shot was good. It just means that you spent a lot of money to get a big image sensor so that you could shoot that shallow. That doesn't make you a good photographer. And I think people are conflating that investment in gear with the seriousness. I'm taking this hobby seriously. That's kind of lame. I don't want to be that guy. I want to see someone who shot something on, like, you know, a Galaxy S7, and you know, it's an incredible shot, and you're like, wow, that person really had an eye for putting that scene together and understood the camera's depth of field and understood that camera's exposure values and really, really solidified something that was evocative of that moment or emotional or artistic, or you know, maybe it was something silly or absurd. Like, I want someone to tell me a story in an image. It doesn't really matter what camera they use. I want to see what story they can tell. So that's at least my feelings on Peter's post. If you would like to join that conversation, you can. Patreon.com/SomeGadgetGuy. OnePlus 10 Pro is good, but it's nothing special. And I think Peter's asking something, you know, really savvy. I mean, where are we drawing the lines on what's good or good enough? I mean, I love it when people are like, oh, but you don't have the true exposure triangle, so you can't learn good photography on a phone. And like, I learned how to shoot on film. Do you think I was ever swapping out a half a roll of film so that I could switch from, you know, ASA 100 to ASA 400 film? No. Film is expensive. If I had ASA 400 in my camera and that's not really what I needed, I shot out that roll of film. So I didn't have an adjustable ISO in the moment. So I only had two branches of an exposure triangle to work with to learn the photography. And if I can't control the aperture on my smartphone, that means I still have the shutter speed and the ISO. I have two branches of the exposure triangle to learn how to shoot on. Oh, Aditya, that's very kind. If you have a dollar to spare, I'd highly recommend joining the Patreon. Thank you so much. Dave Burns, yeah, but I spent a lot of monies. And actually, Aditya has been sharing on the Discord. He's been taking some phenomenal photos with his Xperia 5. He says, I feel a certain reluctance in calling myself a photographer out of the same fear that I haven't actually undergone the same amount of training and difficulties of using a film camera and DSLR. And I'll be the first to say, I don't care what camera you shoot on. If you are making an effort to learn about how you compose a shot and you're trying to create an image with some kind of visual interest, telling some kind of story, I don't care what camera it came from. You are a photographer. Maybe you're a hobbyist, and maybe you want to put an adjective on that. Myself personally, I am most proficient at macro. I love shooting close-up shots of tiny little details in nature. And I'm a really good candid photographer. I love capturing organic moments. Like, I love kind of hiding in the sides of a party and snapping that moment where two people go in for a hug or someone's laughing or, you know, I've got this great photo of my wife. It's in my photography book. But it's, you know, it's this really like thoughtful, contemplative look. It's black and white, and she just looks so beautiful and vulnerable. And it's her looking at a menu in a restaurant. But the instant of seeing her, like thinking about what she was going to eat for lunch, created just one of the most beautiful representations of what my wife actually is. She's such a thoughtful and emotional and considerate person. And even ordering lunch looking off a menu is something that I think tells that story of who my wife is. But if you look at the photo, it's just this like, it almost looks like Renaissancean. Her eyes are down, her chin is down. She's like looking and thinking and emoting. And you're like, yeah, she got the turkey club. I think that's all you need to be a photographer. Do you have a machine that can capture light rays and produce an image? You're a photographer. If you care, you're a photographer, and that's it. You're good. Oh, Al Sabakli, no aperture except for the Xperia Pro. I'm telling you, I'm so excited to see if anyone else starts picking up on that variable aperture trick. Man, I want to see another company. Like, I love the Vivo. The Vivo's, you know, how you shoot on the Vivo, you need to be so careful because you are actually working with a shockingly thin depth of field. So you've got to trust your focus it's kind of scary. You know, you're trying to line up the shot, and if you're off from like tip of nose to eyeball, then the shot's soft. I mean, it doesn't look good. And so far I've been having very encouraging experiences with it, but it's like, you want to start putting those pieces together. Like, I wish I could stop it down a little. And then I wish I had the Sony autofocus with this massive sensor and these HDR and processing capabilities, like so many different bits and pieces. It's so good. How do you even say Xperia? Yeah, Farhan, I was the same. Samsung, I was really sad to see Samsung abandon the dual aperture idea. They got it right the first time with the S9 and S9 Plus. It was great. Even on my S10e, you've got variable aperture, but Samsung went cheap. They tried to reduce and cut costs, and they went up to a larger sensor, and engineering a larger sensor with a variable aperture is extremely difficult. It is not easy. And, you know, they didn't think that they were really making any money on it, so they got rid of it. And this is why I say you've got to vote with your wallet, and you've got to support those features, and you've got to care. So you just keep going, well, Samsung's the best. And so what they did is when they got rid of it, it was the right time to get rid of it. And then you go and you see that feature on a Sony Pro I, and it's phenomenal. It's so good. It improves the experience, and it brings a capability to a phone that was desperately lacking on other phones that needs to be celebrated. Oh, Gabaletta, I love this. My brother shoots airplanes for a living, and he drives three Canons with a multitude of lenses. He's an iPhone and MacBook user for candid pics, videos, and for editing. When I showed him what the One Mark IV can do, he's considering buying one to use it as a monitor and to replace his iPhone for candid pics and videos. I mean, it'd be worth taking for a test drive. If someone really knows how to drive a camera, an Xperia would be real good times. Like, again, I'm always interested to see. Initially, there's always that, oh, I don't know, my iPhone used to do this and that. And you're like, well, but the Sony can do more.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
So, kind of getting into 11 o'clock here. Let me take another drink of water. I'm going to mute so that you don't hear me slurping. That's super gross. So, I've been having a real good time with stylus-enabled phones. It's been kind of refreshing going back to the Note 22, the Samsung, going to a Samsung Note, really fun. I really can't say enough nice things about what the Note 22 represents for how awful I think the S22 actually arrived. But then immediately on top of that, I was critically anxious because Motorola has this Folio case with a Bluetooth-enabled stylus that communicates with the phone and also delivers a stylus experience. This is very similar. I've got it over here on the side too. This is very similar to the sort of idea of the LG V60. the phone is not any more expensive for having the digitizer in the device. Like, both of these represent a cost savings, a minor, but a cost savings over a comparably spec'd Galaxy, but they include support for a feature you just need to buy an extra accessory to use. The Folio case is going to get its own standalone video, its own, not standalone video, but it's going to be a part of the wrap-up conversation that I'm having on this. My only criticism so far from going back to this Edge, the Folio case puts the stylus in the center, not quite the center, it's just off to the side of the camera module, but it's in the center so that when you put the phone down on its back, it waka 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 as if you want to leave the display up so that you can see it. So that's super annoying. The way that this is housed also makes it a little bit more difficult to just pull the stylus out. Once you do, the case is communicating to the phone that the stylus has been removed. It's very similar to pulling the stylus out of the silo on a Note. It detects that this has been removed from the back of the phone. The phone is in a ready-to-use state. It immediately, I've set it up to immediately pull out a notepad so that you can scribble notes with pressure sensitivity and all that good stuff. Like, this is what it should feel like. I want it to have that note-like experience, and I like those kinds of shortcuts being built in directly. But the way that you pull the stylus out is just a touch more deliberate than if you had it on a silo. So that it's one of those things you kind of got to get used to. And I wonder if this like elastic sheath is going to wear out, like how long it's going to take for it to wear out. And then maybe you're walking around or you're holding your phone and the stylus can slide out of the Folio case. That might be kind of a bummer. But in the initial early reactions, the case is very well considered. I love that the stylus isn't too much of an obstruction. Like, it doesn't feel that much different in my pocket. And then it also gives you that cute ability to wrap the case to make it like prop up, and you can use it like it's a little stand. So even if the phone is going waka 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 on the table, if you don't want it to flop around too much, you can use the Folio case to prop it up iPad style, and then it's much better secured and it's much better positioned. So early responses, this to me is now the true complete experience of using a Moto Edge Plus. And that kind of leads me into TCL, because TCL is also doing something kind of interesting. This is the TCL Stylus 5G. There's a little stylus silo on the bottom. That's not really showing off. Come on, camera. There we go. So it just kind of pops out and it clicks, and then you can slide it open. And again, there's like a little notepad that you can start doodling and scribbling on. This does not have the same, you know, angle, tilt, pressure sensitivity. This is a more simplified capacitive. I believe it's capacitive. Actually, no, we can test that. Let's see. I've been using it this whole weekend. I didn't even think to test if this was a capacitive stylus or if this was a, if this does have a digitizer on it. And it does seem to interact with my, yeah, my Bamboo is also giving us these little capacitive scribbles. I'm going to follow up with TCL and figure out exactly what kind of pen is in here. But the touch rejection is really good. When it detects that one thing has started touching the screen, then the other thing does not work. So if you start scribbling with the pen and then you try to touch with the finger, like I'm doing right now, the finger doesn't register as pen input. What it does instead is if you wiggle too much from both, it tries to treat it like a pinch to zoom, which is really handy. So if you're scribbling with your pen and your thumb is accidentally touching the screen, you can keep scribbling, but your thumb isn't going to add to the scribbles. Instead, it will eventually use that as a command to zoom in, zoom out. So at least like you might accidentally zoom in on your note, but it's not going to add extra touches. And same thing, if you're doing something with your thumb and you're moving stuff around, the pen stops inputting data to the screen. Very, very handy. The other thing that I really like, TK pointed this out on our stream on Thursday on Best of Our Week. So this is the pen. It's got a little click. It goes in. It feels very similar to a Note 5 pen. If those of you are old like me, and you can remember back to previous generations of Notes, but there's a magnet inside the phone that helps suck the pen into the silo. So here, I'm going to try and get this on camera. Apologies to those of you listening on the audio. My camera is not focusing. There we go. Had to block my eyes. So I'm just going to lightly push, and eventually you saw it just sort of scooch in all by itself. And it's just a nice extra little consideration that you're using the pen. Let's say this gets clicked and it gets kind of pulled out a little on its own. The phone does try to keep the stylus in the silo for you until you deliberately pull it out. It's almost kind of two-stage. Like there's like a light, oops, caught it right between my knees. Look at that. There's a light little insert where it goes first, and then there's a harder one where as it goes a little further into the silo, it snicks. I mean, it feels like Wolverine, you know, like snicking the claws back in, and then you just click the little pen release edge and it's all the way back in the phone. Beautifully considered. This phone is such a wonderful consideration for a productivity, business, communication focused device aimed squarely at the hole in the market left by the LG Stylo. I know so many people like to make fun of the Stylo. It was a cheap phone. It was kind of pokey. But there are people who are ride and die LG Stylo fans. And it's a phone that I really should have followed up with a little bit more just because it was so inexpensive. It was kind of pokey. It wasn't like a screamer performer. It could get bogged down pretty bad. But the headphone jack was way better than it had any right to be. The cameras were a little slow, but the photo output was surprisingly good. And now TCL is jumping into a 5G capable, stylus enabled phone with a stylus silo. It's built in there. Headphone jack, expandable storage, upgradable memory. I haven't dug too deep into the cameras. I haven't been shooting on this phone too hard. Fingerprint sensor and the power button, just really well considered all around device, and it's going to sell for about $250. And I feel like that's the right place where you can make a few compromises over a Note and arrive at kind of a Stylo device, and really feel like you're not hurting too bad. I mean, again, I've been saying this on the Redmi videos, on the Poco videos, the Infinix videos. At around $300, you are still doing way better than just covering the basics. And I feel like TCL is now representing that at the sort of low-cost carrier. You go into a Boost Mobile, you're going to see this phone full retail for like $260. If you get it on T-Mobile, they'll just give it to you for free. Like, just take it. You don't have to pay for it. You're signing up a new line. Here, it's yours. This is like the free phone on contract. And for a free phone on contract, this is remarkably good. So I've been very impressed. I'm going to be putting together sort of a full video. And it's little things too, like TCL is skinning. Like, it's kind of interesting, like how they present. Again, I don't think I can get this to focus on my eyes very easily because the screen's also kind of reflective. Come on. There we go. Oh, no, it almost did it. And then my eyeball peeked through from the side. And NVIDIA is going to make this all seasicky. There we go. Like, there's almost a Windows Phone kind of vibe to your notification shade. So all of the Material U buttons and panels are really big and blocky and rectangular. But the phone is also customizing smaller toggle buttons and squares. And it's a really clean look. And the way that the notifications kind of scroll up from that, they're all mounted a little bit lower to the bottom half of the screen so you can interact with your notifications. Stuff like that is really well considered. It's simple. It's not as flashy as like FunTouch or MIUI or any of these other heavily skinned kinds of phones, but there's definitely been a consideration from TCL about sprucing up their Androids just a little bit. So, TCL Stylus 5G, this is a good replacement. We now have two phones for people who want pen touch input. You know, maybe it's an accessibility issue or maybe it's a productivity issue. They don't need to go and spend $1,000 on a Note 22. They can get a pretty fair approximation and representation of this for $250 or free on a new line. Again, I'm like, the amount of phone you can get for free is kind of remarkable. So yeah, I've been bouncing into this pretty heavy. Like, I brought my Wacom pen back out for my V60 and my Velvet. I've been playing with the digitizer and the folio case for the Moto, and then this TCL showed up and you're like, oh, these are so good. It's so much fun kind of getting to jump back in and play. And it recalls like all the fun that I used to have way back in the day comparing Palm Pilots against Windows Mobile PDAs. And, you know, even just like, I'm not a particularly talented artist, but I like to doodle and just be like, okay, let me just pull up Sketchpad and kind of scribble away. And then I can just hand the phone over to my daughter and be like, draw something. And she will, okay. And she just goes to town. I mean, it's so fun. It's so refreshing. There's so much to like there. So jumping in, really, really inexpensive and feature complete, decent power on tap. We've got the Dimensity 700, which is kind of a nice step up from where we were. I think this was one of the Helios in the Stylus. I forget which one. I want to say G95. And the Stylus 6 was definitely pokey for having that sort of inexpensive MediaTek in there. But a Dimensity 700 is much, much closer to like Snapdragon 845 performance, maybe 765 performance. Kind of depends on what you're testing and what you're gaming on. $250. We're only just finding older 765 powered phones for $250 now. There's a whole series of MediaTeks that are less performant at $250. I really like playing with the Dimensity 700 at $250. So I'm feeling pretty good. Full video out coming soon-ish when I can spend a little bit more time running the cameras, playing with some of the multimedia, the playback, the speakers. I want to record and test the headphone jack. I'm not expecting audio file from the headphone jack. Oh, the Stylus 6 wasn't a G. Thank you, Farhan. Yeah, I was way off. The Stylus 6 had the Helio P35. That's a way less performant chip, which is why it's so pokey. Faux show. Okay. So yeah, that makes that comparison even more brutal. Now, to be fair, if I buy the phone outright at Boost Mobile, it's like $250, $260. I bought my Stylus 6 at launch. I bought my Stylus 6 outright from Boost Mobile, $140 plus shipping. No, $140 including shipping. Shipping wasn't free. I did not have an account on Boost Mobile. I just bought the phone. It nags me every time I boot it up, like, are you ready to set up your Boost Mobile account? You're like, no, I'm not gonna. But yeah, so I got this phone for $140. I always laugh because like Easy Computer Solutions, Eric likes like, the Stylus 6 is such a piece of garbage. And you're like, Eric, you spent $300 on your Stylus 6 when the phone retailed for like $200. And it was so easy to find on sale for like $1.25 and a half a ham sandwich. So I'm not feeling too bad about liking the Stylus 6 for what it was. But the TCL is showing us where we can go with inexpensive 5G-capable handsets. So it's really been fun stuff. Like on my desk, And the spectrum of devices on my desk has never been more satisfying at all parts of the spectrum. So the Moto rocking my socks as a performance option, the Vivo rocking my socks as a photography solution, the Neo 6 rocking my socks as a really great price-to-performance mid-ranger. Yeah, Barry, I don't understand how anyone could have spent $300 on a Stylo 6. Like, he paid extra to get his Stylo 6. I got mine on sale. I don't understand how he even did it. I mean, I'm sure he found a seller who was like, wait a minute, you want to buy this at $300? Sure, here's the phone, give me $300. So bad. He paid extra. How? I mean, Farhan's correct. I mean, it depended on your carrier. I think I saw it as high as, I think the highest MSRP I saw was $250. That's the MSRP. On Boost Mobile, I think the MSRP was $200. I don't know how he spent 50% more on a Stylo 6 than what like the MSRP was supposed to be. Because you saw the Stylo 6 MSRP $250. You knew you weren't going to spend $250 on that phone. The MSRP on the TCL stylus is $250. A huge swath of people who are going to end up with this phone will not have spent $250 on this phone. A good chunk of those consumers will have gotten it for free. So MSRP, yes, $250. But just like how we always trump up, like, well, Samsung gives me the best trade-in deals. Great. The MSRP is still $899. The MSRP, like, you're going to cut the price of the MSRP through trade-in deals or getting, like, a BOGO or a sign-on, you know, signing on a new line of service. The same thing happens to cheap phones, too. So you go from, well, it's a $250 phone to it's the free phone. You got it for free with a stylus and a Dimensity 700. Oh, I love it so much. How? Barry Johnson says, this isn't Barry, this is Trey. I have a coworker who swears she paid $400 for her stylo from her carrier, but I was like, it launched less than $200. How? I mean, I need my, you know, houseway? How? Houseway? And she's constantly complaining about how garbage LG is because of it. Again, I feel like that's a person who used to compare their Dell against their Mac. And you're like, well, what was your Dell? It was like a 10-year-old dust-encrusted laptop that originally sold for $300, and it's just not as good as my new Mac. And you're like, well, yeah, but how much did you spend on your new Mac? $2,500. Well, you think that might be part of the difference? Yeah. Like, anyone's like, well, I finally moved to iPhone and it's so much better. What was your old phone? A Stylo 6? What's your new phone? iPhone 13 Pro Max? Well, yeah. I think you might have cracked the case there, Sherlock. Good job. I really can't remember. There might have been a Stylo MSRP at $300 on one of the carriers, but I just remember so many of them. Again, it was like the summer sales too. The Stylo 6 came out, and Boost Mobile immediately put it on this like summer sale. And it was like $140, including the shipping. And you're like, yeah, I can get a Stylo. I don't even need to ask my LG rep to see if I can get a loaner or a review unit. I'll just buy the thing. And it's been, you know, it is what it is. It's a $150 phone. But it's still doing fine. Like, that would still be a decent media player. Great big screen, great for video streaming. Okay for the occasional camera snapshot, okay to like, oh, I just want to jot out some notes, do something, you know, reasonably quick, not real quick, but just kind of focused at one thing at a time, and then plug in some okay headphones, and it's a good, you know, audio player too. Yeah, that's exactly all the Stylo needs to be. Let me close out this. So, TCL, very, very good. I didn't mean to hijack this part of the TCL conversation talking about, you know, LG and my experiences with the Stylo. It highlights to me, if you buy a phone with purpose and you're picking the right pros and cons for the consumer, what you can arrive at on inexpensive handsets is pretty remarkable right now. And I've been mentioning this a lot, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but listening, when we're trying to be good tech resources for our family and friends, I feel like there's this huge opportunity right now. I don't know if this opportunity lasts. I don't know if getting into the next year of new gadgets and new devices, if we're going to see, you know, the same trend of price hikes. You know, I'm just speaking about this moment. From 2-year-old flagships to brand new purpose-built mid-rangers, we've never been in a better or more competitive market for really satisfying someone's needs. So, like, if someone comes to you and they say, hey, like, you know, I take the occasional, I don't really care that much about the camera, but I really need something for, you know, communication and jotting down notes and getting my work done, or I really want a phone with amazeballs battery life, I don't know that I would push them to high-end premium tier phones. If someone's saying, like, hey, I've got this kind of thing and I want to look at high compute power or gaming, or, hey, I've seen how people are doing like TikTok and things, and I want a phone that's going to be really good for cutting up video, you know, like stuff like that. You can like, oh, there are these options. They're going to be a little bit more expensive, but they can do these incredible things. Then in the mid-range, you know, here's a phone at $450 that is going to perform at like 90% the total compute power of a phone that costs twice as much. Again, if your needs are like 1080p video, you will not feel the difference between an iQOO Neo 6 and an iQOO 9 Pro. Like, when you really get down to brass tacks, shooting off the main sensors, shooting good video, trying to just cut or trim, this is going to be real close. So I feel like now is that we're in yet another phase of this conversation, and it just, it's evolved on us faster than I thought it would, where the daily driver lifestyle experiences on these things are almost indistinguishable from like $200 to $1,000. You're really not gonna feel tremendous differences unless you have an eye towards pushing them a little further, pushing them a little harder, doing a little bit more with them. You want to get into gaming? Little bit more expensive. You want to get into content creation with an eye on like great sensors and great optics with good capabilities? It's going to be a little bit more expensive. You just want to pick up something that does a great job of handling communication, of, you know, tackling your email, sifting through your social media. It's got an okay camera on tap and you can do some fun things with the stylus. $250. $250. Ugh, that's crazy. So, I, like I said, you guys have all heard me ramble on about stuff like that before. It's really great. Play that game with your family and friends, and I think you're going to start blowing some of their minds. Ask them point blank, do you need a phone that's going to be more powerful and can do things that will replace your laptop? Or would you be more interested in a phone that's kind of the same as what you already have, but has a better screen and gets better battery life? I bet you, especially from folks who are on older phones like Snapdragon 845s and 855s, I think they'll care more about the battery life than they will the compute power, the horsepower. And all my family, they're now all on mid-rangers. Less expensive, better battery life, same performance, they're doing good. They're doing just fine. And they're happy with the phone first, and then they're excited because they spent less money. And that's great. That's such a winning combination right now. Mm-hmm. Is
Sorry, I almost spat water all over my keyboard. Dave Burns, work it harder, make it better. I'm always like, let's just take a Daft Punk interlude. Yeah, So apologies. I know I saw some folks in there in the comments like mentioning things like Diablo Immortal. I haven't played a lick of it. I really haven't. Obviously, my family has some personal ties to a certain video game publisher that I have to, out of respect for some of these family obligations, I'm cagey about some of my opinions on a certain video game publisher. But the appeal of Diablo was my World of Warcraft crack. Like, I got real bad into Diablo 2. Like having issues bathing myself and finishing schoolwork and eating on an appropriate schedule, I was in deep on Diablo 2. I never took the plunge on World of Warcraft because of how bad I got on Diablo 2. I desperately want a mobile version of Diablo 2. I don't want Diablo 3. I don't want Diablo Immortal. I want classic OG, non-remastered, not great combat mechanics, old, brutal Diablo 2. Dark and scary and funny and gross. And that's all I want. Kind of like how EA completely ruined Command & Conquer for me. I don't want some weird translation of Diablo 2. I just want Diablo 2. So I know there have been a bunch of headlines like, oh, it would cost you $500,000 to, you know, fully max out one character in Diablo if you wanted all the best gear. I'm inclined to take that headline with just a grain of salt. Tiny, teeny little grain of nuance. Because especially from all the time that I used to grind on Diablo 2 and looking at the sort of loot mechanics of Diablo 3, that's always kind of been a Diablo thing. You don't just max out your character and by the end of the game, you're level 99 with all the perfect gear. Like, the amount of time you would need to play Diablo 3 to fully max out your character would be a significant time investment. So when they go and say things like, oh, but the microtransactions, it would cost you $100,000. Yes, that's true. And probably not accurate. It's probably a lot more money in the real world of how these random number generating loot gotcha mechanics probably function. Someone else was estimating, like, it could be $500,000. The game isn't built to just end run to full level, full maxed out gear. Like, a good dungeon looter is all about trolling through dungeons and improving your gear and building that up over time. And you're never like completely satisfied, right? I don't know of anyone, for all the time that I used to grind on Diablo 2, I don't think I ever finished a character. I don't think I ever got to complete. I would get up to a certain tier where I was like, man, I'm really not having fun with this anymore. Let me roll another character. Let me just start over and just play through this game again with different mechanics and different spells and different weapons and stuff. And then I'd go through that whole process again of building up that character to a certain tier where then I would kind of cap out. The thing I have a problem with Diablo Immortal are like tying all of these things to a character, and this gem system just feels a lot like Marvel Future Fight, where you're paying money to get resources, to roll stats on pieces that then live with one character and can't be transferred, or these improvements don't work across your account, your Blizzard account. They only work on the character. And then that character is tied to one specific tier of monetization. So if you wanted to rank every character, you're spending unique on those characters. So then, yeah, then if you wanted to do my trick of rolling through Diablo 2 characters, that would be significantly more expensive if you wanted to shortcut the amount of time that it would take. Diablo Immortal to me looks like the game where if you're not inclined like me to get suckered into gacha mechanics and want to do the end game runs and the player versus player stuff, where you obviously you're going to be completely non-competitive if you're free to play. That's the whole point. That's where this gets a little insidious, is on the online play, the player versus player, you know, any of the combat mechanics. All of that is going to benefit those who spend a lot of money. The whales are just going to roll steamroller over everyone else in the player base. The free-to-play players are irrelevant in that conversation. But if you're like me, Diablo Immortal might be kind of fine to pick up if I only focus on the story. I make it through the single-player story. I'll probably max out my character at level 60, if that, because I don't even think you need to go that high to beat the game. If you're just kind of playing just for the story section of it, it kind of takes you as the lead in to Diablo 3. So if you're familiar with Diablo canon, then you get sort of your prequel. I believe it's a prequel. Someone please correct me if I'm way off here. And then you're good. I could conceivably try to play Diablo and never spend a dime. But, you know, as I'm also playing around with my Steam Deck, what I really want is to see what has the best translation of a modern dungeon looter that will play well on the Steam Deck. You know, like if it's Torchlight 2, if it's Diablo 2, if it's Path of Exile, if it's any of these other sort of dungeon looter mechanics, like I feel like I'm just fine walking away from Diablo. Diablo Immortal isn't exciting in the way that I always wanted Diablo 2 to be on my phone. My phone would have no issues running classic Diablo 2. My phone is overpowered. This $450 Neo from Aiku is overpowered to run Diablo 2. This shouldn't be a difficult port, but they wanted to go mobile game. And now I think they're suffering some of the ill will of the community right now, where mobile is synonymous with gacha mechanics and microtransactions and pay-to-win mechanics. And that's all kind of true for Immortal. And that's a bummer, because on top of it is what looks like kind of a fun single-player campaign. And that's, you know, that's not a small thing. I can't think of very many phone-focused games that actually do have a good, complete it with no microtransactions single player storyline. Like, that's sort of a dying breed on season pass style games. That's actually kind of refreshing and unique for a phone game. I would just recommend not getting too entrenched or involved in the online play, so that you're not dumping tons and tons and tons of money to try and keep up with Meta on whales who purchase insane amounts of stuff on their mobile games every month. Like, that's what ruined Future Fight for me, was like, I was actually paying every month for just their like basic gem subscription pack, and even that was not enough to kind of keep up with my guild, and my guild was now starting to spend exceeding amounts of money keeping up with the main player metas. So that when we would do guild versus guild combat on maps, it was ridiculous seeing how much money was getting spent every month just to keep up. I mean, you were treading water, and we were a decently competitive guild, and you're like, I literally cannot afford to spend this much money on Marvel Future Fight. The thousands of dollars people would have to spend rolling stats for every single character. There were like, at the time I left, I think there were 120 individual characters. Ranking each character could cost something like $200 each. Then leveling up all of their gear could be like another $500 or $600 in rolling all of this material. You're just throwing this stuff into a random number-generating wood chipper. So in 1 month, if you wanted to rank a character, it could be $1,000 times 120 characters. And then they would introduce new uniforms that would change player abilities. And if you wanted to get those uniforms and rank those uniforms as gear, same process. Could be hundreds more dollars per character. So yeah, I bounced out. So yeah, when we talk about mobile gaming having a bad reputation, it's earned. It's definitely earned. There's a reason why mobile gaming is now bringing in more revenue than console and PC gaming combined. It's on the backs of a very tiny player community of whales who will dump insane amounts of money into these gambling mechanics. And this needs to be addressed. But as it pertains to Diablo Immortal, if you can avoid getting suckered into that spending trap, I'd say at least give the single player campaign a shot and just see where it goes. And I'll keep advocating for Diablo 2 to just come directly to mobile. So we'll see. Yeah, see, Gabaletta, I mean, this is kind of where I was too. And why I would have been happy to just pay a price for a mobile version of Diablo 2, Gabaletta writes, I honestly don't care about being the top-ranking player. I just wanted a modern Diablo game for mobile so I can grind on my lunch break and free time. And you're like, yeah. So, you know, again, without the online play, if you want more of the Diablo dungeon questing, I'd maybe recommend Titan Quest. Instead, I was playing through another character on Titan Quest. I maxed out a necromancer, not maxed out. I didn't reach top level. The top level on Titan Quest is even more grindy than the top level on Diablo 2. But I sort of finished up what I wanted to do with a necromancer. I'm going back to make more of a barbarian style build. It's great. It's fun. You can just kind of keep rolling through dungeons and laying siege to all of these monster bad guys. I had a falling out with Anima because they borked a whole bunch of their microtransactions for... Anima has sort of a microtransaction system similar to Path of Exile, but on a major update, they broke a lot of us that had paid for things like extra stash so you can carry more items. And then when I asked the company about it, they're like, yeah, I guess you'll just have to rebuy them. And you're like, well, I'm not going to do that. Apparently, that system has been better fixed since then. But they aren't going back to older accounts like mine to reactivate our previous purchases. So I'm not going to play that game. But Anima is kind of a decent, fun, mobile version of a Path of Exile clone. But I just desperately want... Give me Torchlight 2. Let me just grind like crazy on Torchlight 2 and do it on mobile. That would be so much fun. But yeah, the mobile versions of these things, the PC ports have been getting much, much better. Like when I can play Alien Isolation on my phone and it runs better than the computer I would have had when Alien Isolation was a brand new game, that's pretty awesome. That's remarkable. So, it's about the time. Let's go ahead and start wrapping it up. Actually, yeah. See, Dustadori's heading out. Gotta head out, folks. Take care. Yeah, that's the end of our mega long edition podcast. We had so much news to get through. let's really put a pin in this one. Tons of streaming happening this week. I think Tech for Your Needs, Lulu, is going to be streaming sometime this afternoon or this evening. Tomorrow is Kimmy, Gadget Goddess, so she'll be streaming on Tuesday. Wednesday is Easy Computer Solutions, so Eric will probably be making fun of the Stylo 6 again. Thursday is Mike and Ike. I believe Tech King Mike is back. Ike Talks Tech, and then that leads into the Best of Our Week with me and TK. And then Friday is LaShawn. LaShawn is streaming the Ignant Hours, which is always a good drunken tech nerd romp through the dirtier sides of tech YouTube. It's hilarious. Saturday should be TK Bay, the Android Bay. And then Sunday, bringing it all back around for El Jefe Reviews, which I believe he's going to be streaming this Sunday. This is an incredible lineup of tech streaming every single week. So thank you for starting it off. I love kicking it off on a Monday so that we can get the week started, start looking at some of these main tech stories, these main tech topics. And I'm going to have a bunch of stuff coming out soon, too. I'm hoping tomorrow or Wednesday will be the part 3 video for the Vivo X80 Pro. And then immediately after that, I can flip around and do the comparison video, X80 Pro versus Xperia 1 Mark IV. I'm just working with Vivo on kind of wrapping up this collaboration. I maybe sent them an invoice for the videos that we've been producing. and then from there, follow up on the Moto, video on the TCL, follow up on the Steam Deck, looking at this new 4K display from YouPerfect. I've got a NAS that I'm building. QNAP sent over a box with some hard drives, and I'm super stoked to start plugging all that together. There's some really good stuff happening, so I'm excited. I'm really excited. It's so much fun, and it's like, man, I've just got to keep all these balls up in the air. I'm juggling like crazy to get this all done. So thank you all, everybody. Thank you so much for joining the stream, jumping in, contributing to the chat. It really has been a really solid couple of months of tech. And really, I don't think the summer is going to slow down that much. It's kind of crazy. Like, the summer used to be tech doldrums. There's nothing interesting to talk about. And I think I'm booked. I think I'm booked through July on stuff to talk about. So thank you, everybody. This has been great. Folks, as always, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.